really welcome our presenters and just indicate that we got more than 400 submissions and we extended the submission date, and then we got more than 900. We went through all of them, and we found that in many cases the proposals were the same, and we decided that those that had something different would be invited. So you are among those that we felt have much more to contribute. So we have not discriminated against others arbitrarily. So we are grateful that you have accepted our invitation to come, and we value much more your contribution, because that will sharpen our insights and make sure that the legislation that we produce is quality legislation. We are going to give each one of you 15 minutes to make the presentation and afford members of the committee to engage. We will start with the Logos Assembly of God, then Kingdom Governance Movement, and then take questions, and then we'll go to Muslim Judicial Council, Congress of Traditional Leaders of South Africa. We haven't seen the submission by the Muslim Judicial Council, but we have no doubt that they know their story. They will be able to tell us what is it that they propose to see. So we will allow them to do that. With your permission, can I then call on the Logos Assembly of God? And, you know, just also a short indication of who you are and so on will be helpful.
Good morning, Mr. Chairperson, Dr. Tole Motsheva, Envoy MP. May I include my introduction or description within my introduction? By introduction, I hereby express appreciation to Dr. Mthole Motsheva, MP, Honourable MP, and the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services for the opportunity to submit this presentation. My name is Albert Wiggins. I've been a resident of the Gawa community for the past 36 years and serve as the pastor of Logos Assembly of God Church, Belhar, since the 1st of April 1995. I'm father of four adult children and a grandfather of seven, as well as spiritual father to many. My wife and I, together with members of our congregation, have been serving both the church and the Belhar community for more than 35 years, with children's needs forming a large part of our community involvement. Our home receives daily visits with hungry, desperate children, often from dysfunctional family backgrounds. Our church engages in feeding many children through a regular weekly program. Our children and youth ministries have served hundreds, if not thousands, of children over the years of our existence within the Belhar community. The same sentiment can be expressed by many other churches and organizations in Belhar. I consider my views expressed to be in the interest of the local congregation, the Belhar community, with a population of approximately 70,000 people, and peoples of our beloved country of South Africa. As stated in my correspondence of 27 January 2015, I express strong disapproval of the decriminalization of sex between children in the age group of 12 to 16 years. God designed this section to be experienced and enjoyed within the boundaries of biblical marriage of adults who generally are physically, mentally, and emotionally more developed and mature than the 12 to 16 year age group forming the basis of our consideration in this amendment bill. The Bible teaches us in Psalm 127 verse 3 that children are a gift from God to us. The fruit of the womb is a reward. The greatest resource our nation has been blessed with is that of children. The value of human life is far greater than her precious minerals or material wealth. Without children, this country will have no future. Without healthy children, this country will have no hope. Without morally sound children, this country will have no future integrity. Without spiritually equipped or empowered children raised in righteousness, our nation will succumb to the evils and vices plaguing our society and be sucked into the vortex of moral decay and destruction. The Bible teaches us in Proverbs 14 verse 34 that righteousness lifts up a nation, but sin is a shame to any people. The contemporary version says, doing right things brings honor to a nation, but sin brings disgrace. Parents in a family are blessed and entrusted by God with children. So too is every nation of the world. Yet often children are identified as amongst the most vulnerable citizens of society and are reliant upon the responsibility and integrity of their custodians, namely parents and the state. They are often a voiceless and defenseless sector of modern society, often victimized, abused, and misused in their innocence, ignorance, and vulnerability. We are further exhorted in Scripture in Proverbs 22:6 to teach your children right from wrong, and when they are grown, they will still do right. I in place on record strong disapproval of the decriminalization of sex between children in the age group of 12 to 16 years old. I do not believe that South Africa will be acting in the best interest of its children to approve the following proposed amendments of Amendment Bill B18-2014. Amendments of Section 1, 15, and 16 of Act 32 of 2007. In South Africa, we consider the age of 18 as acceptable for the following: eligibility to vote, eligibility to marry, eligibility to drive a motor vehicle, eligibility to purchase liquor products from liquor retailers. In South Africa, we consider the age of 21 as acceptable for the following: eligibility to own a firearm, providing stringent requirements are met. It is certainly alarming that we have before us an amendment bill aimed at granting children 12 years of age or older, but under 16, the legal privilege to engage in acts of consensual sexual penetration. The consequences of such a legal decision are certainly far-reaching, and I believe detrimental to the fabric of life of those in question, and the disadvantage of the South African society as a whole. God's design is that sex should be experienced and enjoyed within the boundaries of biblical marriage of adults who generally are physically, mentally, and emotionally more developed and mature than the 12 to 16 year age group forming the basis of our consideration in this amendment bill. Sex between children is not the moral norm and can result in them becoming dysfunctional individuals with emotional and psychological scars. The approval of this amendment will definitely contribute towards the really high and exacerbating incidence of teenage pregnancies, school dropouts, sexually transmitted diseases, and sexually related vices so rampant within our communities. Added into is the potential to adversely affect their future, psychological well-being, and negatively impact upon their adult, marital, and social relationships. Sexual activity between children in this age group should not be discriminalized. Let us be proactive in preventing physical, emotional, and psychological damage of our children by providing safe legal parameters and healthy moral guidelines which can contribute towards producing a healthy and wholesome society who can add value to marriage and the sanctity of family life by upholding responsible, sound moral values and thereby leave behind a good legacy. As a father, grandfather, and spiritual father, I would find it most encouraging and even comforting to know that our government would so appreciate the value of our current young generation and many future youth generations, and thereby do all in its power to provide the necessary legal parameters to ensure adequate protection of our youth from harmful practices and provide them in a safe environment of sound moral influence bringing their growth and development may flourish, thereby contributing to the development of citizens of outstanding character and integrity and role models to the rest of the world. I again express appreciation for this opportunity and conclude with the following verse from the book of Isaiah, chapter 54 and verse 13. And all thy children shall be taught of the Lord, and great shall be the peace of thy children. The Hebrew Bible says, I myself will teach your people and give them prosperity and peace. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Pastor Riggins. Presenter are taking 50 minutes and then we guide you on how much the discussion will be.
Thank you, Chairperson, honorable members, invited guests. The Kingdom Governance Movement would have to state from the onset that we would have this committee, Parliament, instead of decriminalizing consensual sex amongst minors, to effectively come up with a creative clause which will not legalize consensual sex by minors, thus preventing or protecting these minors from abusing themselves or being abused by others, without necessarily treating them as criminals, as it is legally possible. In other words, we insist that consensual sex or sex activities by minors should not be legally punishable, but those who violate that legal principle should be corrected through reasonable and acceptable legal measures. We are aware that this is an order of the Constitutional Court, in which case Parliament is bound to come up with legislation which would satisfy that order. I believe that Parliament should deal with the area of criminalization in a very creative way by coming up with legal mechanisms which would include, for example, the faith-based organizations, traditional communities, and other concerned groups, including within departments like social development. So we appeal to Parliament to do that, because if we simply do away with the clauses which stands now, it means we are compounding the challenges we are facing as a nation. We say so because there are people who are deliberately, you know, campaigning for the states to pass such legislations which we believe they are corrupting, you know, our society. We are aware that there is a plan which is called 10.9 by Alice Bailey. I want members of Parliament to ask their researchers to look into the activities of these groupies, because these people are well-financed and they are lobbying in all the countries. I've got articles, for example, when Uganda was dealing with similar legislations, Nigeria and Malawi last year, they were confronted even by President and President UN, or rather US Secretary General, confronting them that they should pass these kinds of legislations. So this is not an accident. This is a planned campaign to corrupt our society by people who have, you know, made themselves agents of Satan, if I can put it that way. Therefore, we must not allow our democratic institutions like parliaments and so on, or governments, to be used as agents of the forces of darkness. So your researchers must do research on this matter.
Yeah, the president of Uganda, for example, was claiming that the countries of the West are already trending to boycott Uganda, even in terms of economic activities. They were going to cancel the loan they have made to the World Bank simply because they are protecting their society from such lobby groups. Same applies in Nigeria, same applies in Malawi. Malawi had to pass this piece of legislation because their aid from these countries was not going to be approved. For example, this plan of Alice Bibili, the 10-point plan, says take God and prayer out of the education system. The following one says destroy the Judeo-Christian traditional family. The next one says reduce parental authority over their own children. The next one says make sex free. And then if sex is free, legalize abortion, make divorce easy. And the pieces of legislation were passed, if you check, coming from the legal fraternity, are forcing us to do exactly that. If 12-year-olds are allowed to have free sex every day, and we allow them to do abortion without even the consent of their own parents, they become victims then of people who want them for pornography and all that kind of stuff. So we are opening up our society to forces of darkness, and by the time we wake up, our people will be accusing us as parliamentarians. Will be accusing us as leaders, as religious leaders, and all that, to have worked in cahoots with these forces and lose confidence in their own leaders. Our people lose confidence in their own democratic institutions. That is a very dangerous situation. So we propose strongly that let's not look this thing in piecemeal as this is presented to us deliberately. Let's look into this thing holistically. These people are transforming our society. They are leading the transformation of our society. And we are just supporting them in the way. So I propose that we consider doing the legal mechanism to avoid the situation where we worsen the situation because we are faced with teenage pregnancy and all that. Our young people are taking e-grant and they are taking getting pregnant time and again because they want that money because they are unemployed. So the situation won't be worse now. Who amongst ourselves would have a 12-year-old to be engaged in sex? If then there is nobody, whose agenda is this? Which is saying our own children, year 12, must have free sex. Who is our master in South Africa in this case? I think these forces of darkness, we cannot allow ourselves, you know, to get in that fashion. Mama Sobo is a mother within the movement. I would like her to take a few minutes from where she is sitting. Just even if it's 2 to 3 minutes, because she feels strongly that as mother, she must speak on this matter. Let me check. I left some minutes. I calculated. Yes, I left some minutes.
Thank you. In the 2 minutes I have, in a nutshell, this matter means, if this matter is morally correct and it legalizes children who are minors, if they commit any criminal offense and they have to appear in the court of law, they will be treated as minors, which means they are not suitable to make their own decisions without the parent support. So if they can have sex free, and that is taken as into a young savings, if I may put it, yes, cause, we are really destroying this nation. As a person who has grown up in the rural and in the urban, from both homesteads, I have never, my father has washed and bathed me until I turned 18 years old because I was not engaged in sex. And I strongly believe and I trust and I know that women that are spoken to out there in Kayelita and in Bukulethu wanting to discuss this matter with them, they actually said, if it happens, okay, if it happens, because it's a name. Yes, if our communities are not supporting Parliament, which I think Parliament is really in a tight corner because the Constitutional Court has taken a decision on this matter, we would be failing our children. We would be failing generations to come. We would be failing the nation as a whole. Abantu, which means our children, needs to be protected by us. A 12-year-old who is alleging incest, I've proved, I've seen, I know NGOs that I worked with, they are not mentally stable. They cannot be mentally stable. We have homesteads that are led by children because of the sort of HIV and other reasons. And those children then will be vulnerable. They will be taken and they will be used and they will be dumped. And then this country will have to face a big amount of taxpayers' money to wipe that mess, because those babies of those children, now the country will be looking after two children instead of one child who is 12 years. Because when a 12 years produces a child, and then there's two children that are faced to be taken care of by the state. So as KGM, as myself, as Tandi Sobo, from Kainicha, I strongly oppose that children should be vulnerable to this act. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Sobo. Maybe we should clarify something from the outset. Maybe we should clarify something from the outset as to whether or not the amendment seeks to permit you to engage in consensus, or whether or not the amendment recognizes that this is happening. And because it is happening, it forces the law to prosecute these children. And the consequences of such prosecution are very damaging to the children. And now also, that places another responsibility on the correctional centers. Now, if you reverse this matter, the question again is, should we actually deal with that area through the criminal justice system, or should we say the responsibility to ensure that this does not happen still falls on the shoulders of the parents, civil society organizations, faith-based organizations, traditional institutions? Now, then the other question will arise. Are we then admitting that these institutions, social institutions, have failed? And now because they failed, we want to take this and put it on the shoulders of the state. Is that what we are saying? So I'm just saying that so that when we move forward, we should really understand where the challenges are. Because you see, as Mr. Matumela was proposing, you can make a law which prohibits something and not attach a penalty. Otherwise, it's meaningless. This is not allowed, but if it's done, nobody can say anything about it. So those are the things that I think we need to look at.
but also this also raises another question. But you see, Parliament is elected by the majority of the people, and whatever positions we take must reveal, must conform to the will of the people as a whole. So it would be important that as faith-based organizations, who are thousands in number, you should seek to have dialogues amongst yourselves, and that would assist. Because now the two groups come out of maybe 5,000, and you speak. What ways do we attach to that? Do we say that the faith-based community in the country has taken this position, or 2 out of 5,000 have taken this position? So I think that some work has to be done out by ourselves as society before we appeal to government to say, or parliament to say, do this or don't do this. But these are just my gut feelings that I want you to bear in mind when you address this. I'm not trying to channel you. I don't have the authority to do so. So I'll open up the discussion. Honorable Bonga. When you respond to the MPs, then you can touch on these things, but let us let the MPs.
No, thanks, Chair. I think it's a very interesting, debate, which I think we may have to, I don't know, through each other, we may have to have a summit general that would include all faith-based. All faith-based, because we as Parliament were put in a predicament. Because the other faith-based organization does come here and raise the issue that no, we support. Another faith-based organization also comes here and says, we don't support. So as a legislature, we are put in a serious predicament now of having to look into this thing. But if all the faith-based organizations would have a summit and just discuss, among others, to discuss this very matter, that what is the view? What is the view of the faith-based organization on this subject matter? But secondly, to discuss on how do we want to assist Parliament and the civil society organizations in the country on how to take issues that affect young people as a whole, particularly these issues, because it's not only related to sex, there is a problem of drugs, problems of alcohol abuse and so on and so forth. Most young people found in taverns and so on. But I see faith-based organizations to be a key role player to assist us, not in terms of taking them there, but preaching. By preaching and so on and so forth. Because when we were speaking there, myself, I'm a Christian myself. But now I must not be caught up between me being a Christian and me being you see, I must not be caught up in the two, because on the other hand, as the people of South Africa, we have agreed that, we have agreed on the constitution, that's one, and we have agreed that the constitution is the supreme law of the country, and any law that is declared by the constitutional court to be either inconsistent with their constitution is invalid. That is pretty much the point of departure. So that being the point of departure, we need to say, how do you assist? How do you assist a state-based organization, civil society, or how do you assist this constitution to be viable and to break it? Because now we've traumatized the accounting 10-point plan that we analyzed existing. And I'm not aware of those kinds of things. You see, and I'm not aware. So now the point of departure is that we need to respect the constitution. The constitution is the supreme law of the country, and now we've been directed, which, in my view, again, we need to make that point very clear. We are not legalizing. This amendment does not seek to legalize the consensual sex amongst adolescents, but it just to say this has been identified as a serious problem, but just decriminalizing it, saying for it to happen, it used to be a crime, but now it must no longer be a crime, which means that governments, faith-based, and all of us must now come up with strategies on how do we please discuss the decision of the Constitutional Court to clear up this thing. But from where we're sitting, we think that the Department of Health, the Department of Social Services, even the Department of Human Settlement, because when people are settled, also just need them to do some of these things, and ourselves, and faith-based, because we feel that this moral regeneration program, if you're not taken up its toll, because if it can take its toll here, we can deal with a lot of problems just by telling people about the verses that you are quoting and all these other things, so people can, you can talk to their hearts. We're not talking to our people, businesses, means are more than we're supposed to do. But now the legislature is faced with this problem, and we would really want to appeal that we need to just change our attitude towards dealing with this legislation. And the attitude of starting by saying, I'm a father of 9, and the grandchildren are 13. You think we say we have already taken a corner that says, I'm just looking at it in a subjective way. But we need to get out of the way we are personally or as organizations and just look at it objectively and say, here is the problem, how do we deal with it? Because as parliament, we are not only leading Christians, we are leading all the sectors. The communists, they also expect our leadership. Capitalists accept our leadership. And Christians expect our leadership. So we need to come closer to all of these people. So I think we need to appeal to everyone, and let's come closer, let's leave our positions wherever we are. Let's try to come closer towards each other and see whether we can find the common ground which will just close, which will close this gap. Yeah, for now, let's see.
Thank you. Became contracted, you know. But these are two things which I did not come with a solution. I think I want to reiterate what Mr. Pomer said. If you could, he said that you have, there must be, when there is a mission, there must be punishment. Like, if you don't do this thing, this is what's going to happen to you. If it is not the children, who then must be punished? They're going to use the African way of saying the parent must be punished. How are you going to do it? This happens. If you come up with a solution, it's much better. We understand all morality and all those things, that good things happen, this is the thing. So, come up with a solution. If you are in our position, what would you do? We have to decide whether we make a criminal offense to the children of that age. Or what do we do? Thank you.
The person, Mr. Wonga, addressed quite at length on a number of issues which I don't necessarily agree with, but I don't know if there's enough time to engage on those issues. What I do want is just put up there for us to consider, where Mr. Wonga says we are not legalizing consensual sex. But we've got members here from rural areas that have put a very good submission to us. And we need to understand what is the perception out there amongst voters. How do voters perceive the difference between decriminalization that is now being found to be unconstitutional, and what is the impact of that? Is it not really, as the EFF member in our last meeting indicated, that if you decriminalize something, you are actually allowing it? Now, we understand the Constitutional Court ruling, and we understand the baskets that have to be weighed with the problems with criminalization and the fact that young girls do not seek assistance and do not speak, and the abuse of the criminal justice system through that. But at the same time, we need to really set the hearts of the people that made submissions, and we haven't heard submissions from rural areas. And that is why simply we don't have time. It would be good to visit the rural areas and to have an impact. You can understand what is the impact, because we're sitting here under pressure now to finalize this, and we need to understand what are the majority of people saying. Do they have an understanding of what you're doing? Because the question of legitimacy of parliament comes into the issue. And so, Chair, I do appreciate what they've said, and I think that when Mr. Bonga says we are not only leading Christians, but we've got to understand that the 80% or more of the country are Christians, but there are other faith organizations that also have concerns about this legislation. How do we find a mechanism? And I think it's also not correct to say that people can't put a subject of view, that I'm a father and this. I think that they can, entitled to come to Parliament and express that view. Obviously, we then evaluate the submissions they are made. But I think, Chair, that we need to be careful in the way we approach the submissions that are made. Clearly, the summit is a good idea. We've already spoken about it. But you're not going to get consensus amongst all faith groups on the issues. We had the same issues when we had the abortion issue. We had a lot of different views on that. But at least we need to listen, seriously consider what members say. But the question I'd like to put to the submitters is, we are sitting with the issue of a constitutional court that, while I might not agree with it, it is something we have to abide by. And what we are looking at is some mechanism to assist where young adolescents are engaging in inappropriate sexual behavior. And the state, the court has already found that the state has got, it's an important consideration where you've got risks of teenage pregnancy, HIV AIDS, psychological and emotional risks. Would you have any thoughts on a mechanism from your societies or the involvement of social workers or something like that? That I'd like you to comment on that, Mr. McDermiller, if you could. And then Pastor Regan's just George Spirons in Belhar. What is the implications now when this message gets out for gangsterism in schools? That's a concern of mine, where you have young girls that, or young boys that are then, do they have cognitive development to be able to say yes or no? And where you've got gangsters infesting areas and where a young person might consent and say, yes, I'm consenting because I want to get involved in this gang, with the implications of that. So just those short comments. Thank you, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson Roy. A question to the two presenters is the following. Do they feel that given the Constitutional Court judgment and the fact that Parliament currently has been proposing to decriminalise consensual sex between adolescents, that such a decision will in any way prevent them from a faith point of view to still preach abstinence to adolescents? Do they feel that the freedom of religion and religious choices in respect of sex will be impacted by the proposed bill?
Before you respond, I think we need a global attention to this matter. We have a situation where these sexual activities between adults escalate because there are certain causative things in society. For instance, every street in the African townships, there is a tavern open from Friday to Monday. And on your television, there is nude sex throughout the night. Mm-hmm. And there are no police who are sitting in front of televisions to make sure that these children are not watching. You go into the bookshops, there is pornography. Now, the question is, should the faith-based organization just be concerned with what the parliament wants to do, or they must also address these things that causes these consensual activities? So,
I think that we need a total solution. What are faith-based organizations saying about the taverns in the townships that are open 24 hours, all weekends, next to the schools? What are you saying about the media? What campaigns are you having to deal with those things, because they cost what you don't want to see? And you see, I hear the suggestion that they go to the rural areas. There are some religions which say that what the traditional communities do is pagan, is hidden. But traditional communities have taboos. Through the application of taboos, they prevent this kind of activities. But now on Sundays, other people go and preach that anything that relates to taboos is pagan, is hidden, and the traditional communities then stop doing it. And because they stop it, then the outcome is this conceptual act. So I think that I want to agree with Honorable Bonga that I think we need a societal dialogue on these issues. But you see, government cannot wait until that dialogue has taken place. Government has got to address immediate issues facing, because if we don't have an amendment like this, we must go into the informal settlement, into the townships, where the police vans cannot even enter, to arrest these children and send them to prison, and then overcrowd the prison, the cops, and then send them to prison, and the correctional centers are full. I think let's look at the matter broadly, but as parliament, we are in your hands, we rely on your wisdom, and that's why we're giving you this page to advise us. And we will listen and we will take into account what you're saying.
Chairperson, honourable members and invited guests, thank you very much for your comments. I want to just, in time to respond, make a few points. It seems to me that we are seeing government institutions like parliament and executive have no responsibility to protect our values. If we take that stance, then it would mean we fail to represent the people who voted us into power. So I would advise that let us approach this matter from a collective perspective, as we have said. That the government elected by the people have got a responsibility to protect the values of that society. So if you take or you pass legal mechanisms which are undermining those values, you're making it very difficult for the people to apply and uphold those values. For example, there was a campaign here by the Minister of Social Development that we should not spend our children at home, 2014. Now, effectively, that is taking away parental authority. So if you take legal positions to undermine parental authority, then government must take responsibility for what is happening within society. Number two, if we compare parental authority and children's rights, it seems as if we do not have a balance of that, when we try to protect children, we protect them outside parental authority. That is very dangerous for society. I think the government must know that it represents the interest of those people, and we must work with those people so that we reach, you know, an amicable solution to challenges of this in the society. Now let's take an example. I'll come back to the issue of the constitution very quickly. I mean, we're all children here. Those who want to play social games, they will say, let us play. No child will say, no, okay, let us play. You know the hide and seek story we used to do. Let us play. Now, once you have removed that, although you may say legally, you are not legalizing as you are saying, but to an ordinary person, once you pass that legislation, you must know and take full responsibility that you have said now it is legal for minors to engage in sexual activities. And remember that I said earlier on, if your child is 12 years in terms of child protection, children doing abortion without the consent of the parent. Now imagine a situation where I get to my house and the honorable member who said you must not be parents or being a Christians or Muslims when you come to parliament. That is another problem. If you come to parliament, you said when you enter that place, you say you are no longer upholding values which make people to have confidence in you. We have problem with that kind of attitude. I enter my house, here is a 30-year-old, another as a widow, a 13 or 13-year-old girl being sex in my house. What do you expect me to do? What do you expect me to do? You say because I'm a praying person, I'm a saying, Father, help me without taking action. So you are putting us in a very difficult situation. And this is already happening now, Honorable Chairperson. Our people are saying this democracy has sold the soul of our own people when it comes to values. As if you don't have responsibility to do that. Now, media and so on, we know, you know, when you protect your own body, I know what you say about media. It's a media which is granted authority by government to show this type of stuff. The government which is supposed to say no to this stuff, you can't blame communities on the rejection. When it is government which is legalizing pornography to show 24 hours, I know that there's a case around that. So you can't blame communities, but take full responsibility for that. Now, finally, let me come to the tablets. Who is giving authority to tablets? This government starts us. So government must take full responsibility. You can't share the responsibility when you see consequences of the legislation or the permits or licenses you have given the government. Lastly, sir. No. The solution, let me give you a solution. The solution would be to amend this liberal constitution.
You are protected.
Yes, I know, I know. We're coming from the same trend. I know, he's just abusing me. No problem. Solution, a radical one would be to amend this liberal constitution. Because this liberal constitution does not represent the values of the vast majority of the people of South Africa. And therefore, if we don't do so, you will be in this situation time and again. So let us look into this constitution and ask, why are the loopholes? I normally say to people, I could not have seen the loopholes myself because I was part of the ruling party, because we are excited that we have the biggest freedom. But those countries which wanted to compromise our society knew exactly what clauses to put in there so that they are able to advance their agenda. So we are in this situation, we can't blame a government for now. Because we are put in this situation by people who are planning to corrupt society, and therefore I'm saying, let us be bold and look into this liberal constitution and say, which areas are compromising our values? And this thing must not be about religion, Jefferson, because religion is divisive. Let's look into our values as a society. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to answer the Honourable Member of Parliament who asked a question about when we preach, do we think the abstinence, yeah, Mamel Vana when we speak abstinence. Once there is a right, once people out there, they just hear the word right, once community hear that you've got a right, even if they don't interrogate the ins and outs and they don't know constitutional court and parliament, all what they're listening for is right, it's my right. And then they will, you can preach and preach, I don't know, 100 sermons per day, they will not, I mean, adhere to whatever you are telling them. So I just had to address that and that's, yeah.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I
somewhat concur with our speaker as regards the opportunities of preaching. We will continue to preach what we preach based on biblical basis, irrespective. And it's unfortunate that there's so much compromise in moral standards across the spectrum of our nation, and even the constitution which we have, which causes so much challenge in certain areas that we grapple with as a nation. I also would like to say that 12-year-old to 16-year-old children are often not sufficiently mature to adequately discern the pros and cons of many of the actions that they find themselves entrenching. And the references made earlier to what one would call maybe a facade to certain causes with a hidden agenda is something of great concern, which is not just in our own country, but is a worldwide phenomenon. And the ever-increasing victimization of women, young children, sex trade, etc., can be first fueled by the decriminalization of sexual interaction of a penetrative nature, consensually between the target group here, between the age of 12 and 16. And I think when speaking as a father, I'm not doing that in a subjective way. I'm using it as an illustration that every man in this room should be thinking that way. I'm not sure if the Honourable MP is here, the father. He's not here at the moment, but he made a comment about that. You never understand fully the responsibility of a parent until you become a parent. And once you become a parent, you realize it's far greater than you ever thought it would be. And you no longer look at things through just idealistic ideology or political agendas, but you're realizing that you are responsible for generations that flow forth from you. And you need to take responsibility for that. And so as fathers, we need to look beyond our own family, beyond our own community, but across the nation. I think our late President Mandela was a true example to us of a father in this nation. Not just a political person of renown, but as a statesman, as a true father for the nation. And I think we should be able to consider that as many others that have taken a stand as fathers of nation, and not merely as presidents or prime ministers holding office. And so when we speak as a father or a mother, we speak about the burden of responsibility, not just for ourselves, but for the generations that follow. The reference to the question posed by the Honourable MP Steve Swartz, in the community that we find ourselves in, Belvoir, and many other communities as well, many of our young people do not have the cognitive responsibility of what they're doing. They're gunning people down. They're shooting. 2 nights ago after our church, there was gunshots going haywire. As the drug wars continue between people, and there is no discretion in these actions, and even cannot even think about the value of life when they gun them down like that, how much more they can consider with a abusing the life of a 12-year-old in a prostitution consideration, how much more would they even consider that with cognitive responsibility? So, morally, there's a great cry within our nation. We need moral reform in our nation. We can put all these statutes in parliament, but we need a moral reform in the hearts and minds of our political leaders that are voted in by different members of our society. And we are facing many challenges, even right here in Parliament, as we've seen of late. I thought to myself, maybe off the point here, but the word Honourable Speaker, Honourable Member of Parliament, sometimes those words are used and we're seeing dishonourable things happening in our Parliament, which is no example to us. I'm making that in context to morality, not specifically what's happening, but I'm talking about morality. And we can use terminology without the evidence of the terminology. And on the basis of this topic here, the MP that left the room, Bosti made his comment, I equate
decriminalization or legalization, decriminalization I equate with legalization in this particular context, because that's the outflow of that. Thank you so much.
I'm not speaking for governments. I'm a member of parliament. We oversee what the executive does. But I know that on the 4th and 5th of July 2012, government under the leadership of the president convened a summit on social cohesion and nation building to address the whole issue of values in society. And a declaration was adopted. And civil society was invited. And I know that there's a program in government to hold dialogues, to offer civil society, religious bodies, an opportunity to express themselves on this matter. But I don't remember any faith-based organization or a group of them convening a meeting as a follow-up to what was done. And I know that our icon Nelson Mandela launched the moral reform. You are saying we need a moral reform. But government under Nelson Mandela created a platform for what we are putting for. But I don't remember any faith-based organization convening a conference or something to build on what Nelson Mandela did. So I'm not sure that it is government that is failing to discharge its responsibility, or that ourselves as a civil society are not taking advantage of the space that government is creating. Also, I don't think that there's any government which wants to take away parental authority. Society has developed, and if you look at our society, they are child-headed households. And those kids who are heading these families themselves are children, they need support. There are families that are headed by drunkards whose job on arrival at home is to beat up women and children. Are those the parents that you say government must leave the authority in whose hands? So I think, having said that, I want to come to what Honorable Bonga said. I don't think that he meant that when you enter parliament, you must leave your religion outside. He can't say that, and I don't think he was saying that, because religion is protected by our Bill of Rights. As this parliament, we respect all religions, we give them equal status, and that's why we invited you to come here. So, Honorable Bonga, I don't think he was saying that. All he was trying to say is that let's look at the matters holistically. But also, you see, before we make laws, we have public hearings like this because we value your contributions and we want to learn from you, so that the laws that we make don't belong to the few of us who were elected to be in parliament. The laws must reflect the will of the people, and without you, there are no people. You are the people, so we can't ignore what you're saying. We will always listen to you. But lastly, I want to come back to this question. That traditional communities have social taboos. And these social taboos have an important role to play. You take the Muslim community, they have madrasa schools. The Hindus have the Hindu schools. The Jews have temple schools. Traditional African communities have initiation schools. Let's not take away the responsibility of those social institutions to do their work and come to government and say government criminalize children, because that would be counterproductive. I have only two hands, and then from there we move to the other presentation. I'm happy that you have all submitted written proposals. So my remarks are not conclusive of anything. This committee is still going to look at your presentations seriously. Can you?
Thank you, Chatterjee. Honorable Chatterjee, I was going to
with regards to the issue of.
Is that a member of parliament?
Are you a member of parliament?
What? Part of your delegation.
Oh, oh, I understand. Okay. No problem. Now we're going to.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just to say that it's quite interesting to listen to the presentations. At the end of the day, what is important is to realize that we are actually dealing with an order of the court. And that order of the court is actually based on the most critical principles that are enshrined in the Constitution. So basically, there will always be a problem when we actually look at our democratic constitution that actually affords various forms of liberties. And putting it in the context of morality, this actually becomes problematic because for now, all kinds of debate is actually slanted to the side of morality, much more than taking into consideration that we are a rights-based society in accordance with the constitutional principles. So basically, at the end of the day, what is important is to look at the problem, and somewhere you hear arguments that are actually saying, if you are decriminalizing it, you are legalizing it. Decriminalization does not necessarily mean giving it a go-ahead or saying, yes, it's legal. We are actually trying to regulate something that is about really, as South Africans, continuing with our agenda to continue to promote protection, proper protection, development, and survival of African children. And what will be said will be, to utilize this platform, to actually try and reopen other debates. Because somehow in the way I hear us talking about abortion, the choice of termination of the pregnancy act, that has been dealt with already. And we know that there have been issues, there were a little bit contentious between those acts. But that is a close debate. And one thing that we need to actually take into consideration is that as we put forward debates, we need to take into consideration that, for example, who is the parent? We know that we are parents, but there comes a time when even the state itself has got to be a parent. Because when parents are failing, for example, then the state has got to take over. And what happens under such circumstances is that saying that the parent, I've got total control of the child, nobody is actually saying anything to me. So we need to actually come up with provisions that are such that they allow us in society to be in the position at all times to actually manage to afford proper protection of our children. And one of the things I just want to comment on is, as we talk, some of the things that we are saying, really, we should really be careful of, like when somebody said the Constitution was put together by people who are corrupt in the South African society. I think it's the last season. I think that actually is an indictment on us. You sit here and maybe accept such a statement, which we need to dispute. They actually say that this constitution has actually been accepted by the people of South Africa after it was put together by people in Parliament. Remember, Parliament does not operate on its own. We consult with South Africans, and that's why today we are here. At the end of the day, whatever you see Parliament doing, it is the will of the people of South Africa. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Majaki, in defense of your Domela, I just want to say, let allow that we'll have different opinions. I think that was an opinion. And let allow the other opinion. You see, a member of parliament was also expressing an opinion. And now if we can have a war of opinions. Okay, no,
this is not war.
I will allow you.
No, there are two things I would love when I was members to consider.
Well, I remember saying we are a right society, as if we're not supposed to be a right society. This is what I was saying. Let us strike a perfect balance. Otherwise, unintentionally, we are destroying our society. So that is one point I want to make. Well, I remember on the Constitution itself, I know now, there are many people who are concerned about the Constitution. I'm talking about members of the ruling party. My challenge to you is that we will have to check whether this liberal constitution is serving
the internet. You know, therefore, I would suggest strongly that the only way to test whether people support the constitution or not is through a referendum. I would therefore say we need then to come up with a constitution which will protect both rights as well as values. That is the constitution that really we should have in this country. And that must be taken to the people. I know there was an assembly, but that constitution was never taken to the people in a form of a referendum. No, I'm not responding here, I'm just making a proposal, Chair.
All of us have rights and responsibilities, and the two are two sides of the same coin. I don't think that this is the time for us to be talking about the referendum and so on, because if I take kingdom mandate, kingdom dominion, kingdom inheritance, your church, it's not necessarily represent your approach to things. It's not necessarily representative of the other faith based on it. And that's why Honorable Bonga was saying that maybe we need a broader dialogue on this. But thank you for your contributions. Also, we have not reached the end of the road. We have had opinions, and I see the other presentations, there will be other opinions. At the end, we can say what is the balance of evidence. We have not yet reached the balance of evidence in favor of this or that, so the dialogue continues. Can we have the Muslim position answered? And you are welcome. Mr. Khalid, we value your contribution. So in future, please put it in writing so we don't misrepresent what you said. We can always be back in check.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. I begin by praising God Allah and sending greetings and salutations upon all the prophets of God, peace be upon them all, and especially the last prophet of God, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And the greetings which is Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, may the peace of Allah be upon all of us, and the blessings of Allah and His mercy. Amen. Honorable chairperson and beloved audience, we should begin by apologizing for not submitting a written submission. I will endeavor to put the submission in writing. It's a submission that will cover essentially five points, and it should be presented as well, God willing. We would request to give an introduction to ourselves. My name is Abdul Fatah Ka. I'm a father of 7 children. My eldest daughter is 9 years old. I'm a member of the Muslim Judicial Council for a decade now. I serve on the Executive Council of the Muslim Judicial Council for also almost a decade now. I serve in the Sharia Court, which oversees many of the issues of regards to marriage and judgments upon Muslim marriages. I'm also simultaneously the Imam of the Salt River Masjid in Salt River, Nurul Islam Masjid is the name. And as an Imam, we deal with the day-to-day issues on grassroots level. As well as an educator and the principal of the madrasa for the last 8 years. And it exposes us to many of our children who come from broken homes, and gives us insight into the day-to-day workings of our community. As an introduction as well, Islam for over the 3 centuries that it has been in South Africa, has enjoyed the right to practice nikah and Muslim-based marriages, and all the protective mechanisms that come with it, where the rights of a person they are balanced by the responsibilities that such a person is expected to be. With regards to marriage, it's obviously the rights of a husband with the responsibilities he must be, and the rights of his wife with the responsibilities that she must be. My first point, therefore, is with regards to the rights, this is the responsibility of marriage. The question might be asked, why are we speaking about marriage, whereas we are talking about consensual penetration or violation of sensuality? From the premise that as a Muslim it is prohibited to have any kind of sexual activity outside the institution of marriage. And therefore it is prohibited and frowned upon because of the right versus the responsibilities. You cannot enjoy the right of intimacy and shirk the responsibilities thereof. If you want to enjoy the right of intimacy, then one should bear the responsibilities thereof. And marriage provides that, as well as protective mechanisms for a suitable and ideal marriage. While intimacy is something which is enjoyable and could become quite addictive in marriage, and because intimacy is protected by marriage, that responsibility then comes with the financial responsibility that is borne by the husband, the raising of children, the seeing to a home, the providing of a good name, and all the other rights that come with marriage. In rights-based responsibilities, I'm referring to the handbook we're given, and in 1.4 it states the Constitutional Court found that Section 50 and 16 of the Act infringes the rights of adolescents in terms of Section 10, human dignity, 14, privacy or privacy, and 28.2, best interest of a child. So we are talking about the rights of a child in that age bracket. In Muslim law, we look upon the right of a child and a child's choice to enter into a marriage, and it is balanced by the responsibility that a child must be. The protective mechanism there is that child's legal guardian will have a massive input in the marriage, and obviously our legacy and our heritage and our being teaches us that all those requirements that will make it possible for a father to fulfill or a husband to fulfill his responsibilities and a wife to fulfill her responsibilities, those are the requirements that need to be met before a marriage can issue, and obviously intimacy can be had. Therefore, combining the responsibilities of marriage to the right that a person has to enter into a marriage to enjoy intimacy. My second point is with regards to intimacy itself. Intimacy must be recognized as a natural attraction to the opposite gender, which we believe is a natural order. And it being natural, it cannot be stopped or prevented. Once it has found seed in a person, and then the only way in which it can obviously be fulfilled is by indulging in the act of intimacy. The guidelines that it is common nowadays that this is found among children as young as 9, 10, 11. We've had scenarios of the rape game that is in play, and we have to read the newspapers to understand that the levels of promiscuity even in children as young as 10, 11, 12 years old. The guidelines of Islam in this regard are that whilst it is a natural need, that need can be suppressed for as long as possible. And the means of the suppression of those needs are based upon not exposing our children at those young ages to such materials which would effectively create the need and accelerate the need for intimacy. And therefore things like pornography and dressing in a promiscuous manner and things such as those are obviously not allowed in the culture of Islam or in the dinner of Islam. To delay the onset of overpowering desires, this is achieved by strong models preventing exposure to explicit material, so that ideally when a child has gone through his childhood years and comes to an age where he or she can fulfill the responsibilities of marriage, they are able to do so in a very mature manner. The first point that I want to make is the third point I made with you with regard to the father as a legal guardian, and in the heritage of Islam should there not be a father, there is a sequence of the legal guardian who is able to then, at the bequest of the child who is becoming a teenager, is able to marry the child off to a suitable spouse as long as all the necessary checks and balances have been fulfilled. The fourth point that I want to make with regard to the submission is that Allah in the Holy Quran, he mentions a very telling verse where he orders the believing men, and in a subsequent word, verse the believing women as well, to lower their gazes and to protect their private parts. We are told that these are the one is the point of departure and the other is the consequence thereof. The lowering of the gazes obviously indicates that non-exposure to promiscuous illicit and nude materials, leading a morally upright life, even as a child, being guided in that manner by the parent. And if that is not put in place, and those morals and values are not found in a family, community, or society, then it's going to lead to a natural consequence thereof, which is intimacy. And if that process is accelerated, it would lead to intimacy at a very, very young age. So therefore, the National Judicial Council sees the society and the values that we have in society as integral in protecting the moral upbringing and the future of our children as well as our society. The first point that I want to make, having touched on, I would like to use the term oversimplification. And the amount of knowledge is decriminalization and legalizing something, but then an oversimplification which could be debatable is that of the choices that are faced is to have, whilst we're being requested to change legislation, keeping in mind is driven by the rights that children have to human dignity, privacy, and the best interest of a child, is that it remains as it is and is not decriminalized, meaning it remains criminalized and prosecution is being put into place. I heard motivations that the ability to do so and the resources at hand to prosecute or to put in place any kind of penal system that would be effective are remote. Keeping that in mind, leaving it as a criminal act and prosecuting in whatever manner is going to be seen by our community as a stand for morals, ethics. Decriminalizing is going to be seen as the promotion of intimacy between minors. What it is and what it is not, understanding all the legalities and how much work goes into a piece of legislation and how it is a tightrope that the parliament is walking, and everybody cannot be pleased in the outcomes of what's going to happen. And we as the Muslim Judicial Council, we appreciate this, extremely appreciative of the fact that we can play a role in the legislation that's going to govern us and our fellow citizens. It is an oversimplification, but that is the feeling on the ground. It has happened before, and it could be effectively what would be the consequence or what would be the feeling on the ground if we have either criminalization and prosecution in whatever manner would be just promoting moral values of a society. Decriminalization would be seen by our lay people as promoting sexual activity between children between those age brackets. I'd like to thank the Honourable Chairperson and the members for allowing a submission that has not been submitted in writing. I've tried to articulate it and also to number it, and in the manner in which I have numbered it, I would hope to relatedly forward this submission to the Honourable Chairperson.
So, we still need it, so to submit it.
And
you are welcome.
Thank you.
No, that's fine. I think it will be important to follow up and get Contralessa's submission. Yes, yes. Something interesting is that occurred. If you listen to the Muslim Judicial Council, they talk about suppression of needs and prevention of intimacy. Now, you see a faith-based organization that accepts the responsibility to do something about the matter. So they are not shifting the responsibility to government. The only thing that they do is to say decriminalization on the ground will mean promotion. And that receives the question of education, that we cannot always say the ground, the lay people. The lay people, if educated, they are even better than us. So, which means we have a responsibility to go to our churches, our mosques, and our other houses of worship to educate the people. Because if we don't educate the people, we are going to hide behind them to
bind government from not acting responsibly. So I want to say that actually the people on the ground, I listen to them quickly, carefully. You look at the talk shows, we go to do constituency work, you listen to them. They are not as lay as we want to believe. I think that we still need to engage on this with us. I will open to the fellow MPs, but as far as I'm concerned, I'm happy that the Muslim Judicial Council is not shaking of its responsibility, and we want to encourage them to continue doing that, and encourage other faith organizations, not one parliament, to do what they can do better. Honorable Sir.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Imam, for your input. There, you mentioned the issue of the perception on the ground. You touched on that. But I think we need to also value what the Imam is saying. He said that the decriminalization will be seen as promoting immoral values. He's got lengthy experience on the ground. He's given us his background. And that is what he is saying. Whether we agree with it or not, we need to seriously consider what he is saying. Yes, the answer, as the Constitutional Court pointed out, alternative to criminalization in education and other methods. But my concern again, Chair, is if we pass this bill, the perception out there amongst the people is that it will be seen to be promoting immoral values. So it is incumbent upon us, obviously, to give a clear understanding of what the Constitutional Court has said and the narrow ambit that it defines. But it is a concern that when we are deliberating on the bill and on other mechanisms to deal with the issue of inappropriate sexual behavior by adolescents, we need to take this input very seriously. And I'd ask the Imam to just add to that, what does he mean by the perceptions on the ground? Because it is a serious concern that we as MPs need to take into consideration. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Chair. Just to welcome the Imam's presentation, and to say that the QCT has actually taken a different direction. And what I just want to emphasize is that we will continue to look at this from the constitutional imperative, but that doesn't necessarily mean that we want to drive out within the society of South Africa now. The fact that we have to continue to be conscious of the basic values of life and moral for society, but cautioning us that what's moral to you may not be moral to me. If you look at a whole range of things that happen in society, if I have to give, for example, just sexual orientation, how we actually manage to emerge within the democratic constitution as something that is one of the liberties that have been provided, and taking into consideration what used to happen previously. The same with termination of pregnancy. Remember, it was a sin to actually terminate pregnancy in South Africa during apartheid era. And it even had laws that were actually governing this. But the fact of the matter was that we were actually losing a lot of young girls from backstreet abortions because of the fact that we had laws like that. Now with this termination of pregnancy act, that keeps on coming about abortion, we don't use young girls anymore. It is called choice of termination of pregnancy, which means choice depends on who you are, in terms of religion.
Sorry, Honorable Jack. I think I must protect her. She really listened to all of us.
Yes.
And if you give her, you get an opportunity to allow her to finish.
Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. So that's basically the argument that you are actually putting forward. You're not really throwing morals and values out through the window as far as African society. But at the same time, because we live in a democratic dispensation, you need to be conscious of other people's rights also. Thank you very much.
You know, happy the question of abortion has been raised. When I was in standard age, I was involved in a debate about Brexit abortion. And we were saying, you criminalize abortion, but the criminalization doesn't prevent people from falling pregnant. And what do you do about them when they are already pregnant? They want to abort. You say it's not allowed. They go to some quack doctor, and then they abort and they die. And life is sacred. Now, if government says we criminalize abortion to protect life, and you say criminalize abortion, which leads to the loss of life, what are we saying? That's why I think this is an interesting debate. No one must prescribe to another, but I think we must look at things holistically and not only from the perspective of our own beliefs system. But with regard to this matter again, Honorable Sant, the question of the people on the ground. You know, Parliament puts a lot of money for constituency work, that MPs must go to the people and explain the laws that we make. But similarly, faith-based organizations must explain. So we must have a literate society, and that will solve many of our problems. If we keep the people uninformed, and then we argue that there are people on the ground who will not accept this or that, I don't think it's even fair to the people. Our people must be informed, and it's our duty, all of us, to inform the people and explain each and everything that we do as Parliament and as religious leaders.
We don't want to go on the issue of abortion, but we hold very strong views opposing that. But in this present context, let me just show you how ludicrous it is. We're dealing here with the age of consent. We're saying 12-year-old children might not have the cognitive development. Our Children's Act says that a child to have medical operation without parental consent must understand the implications of that medical operation. But the termination of pregnancy rules is any child, any person can have an abortion, without understanding the medical consequences. If there's a problem with that, and you need to have a further medical operation, then you've got to get parental consent. So there are inconsistencies, Chair, besides the issue of principle of the whole abortion issue, and I respect we've always been on record to oppose it, and we also will. We understand there is a law in place. That law is not being tested by the Constitutional Court yet. But, Chair, just for the purposes of this bill, we need to understand that there are consequences, and it's useful. One of the this point was raised by the lady yesterday. I think it was from Ratcam or from the Teddy Bear Clinic about that inconsistency. That is an issue for another day to address. But the whole issue of ages is a problem. And one of the persons yesterday handed in that submission from UCT, which sets out the different ages and the inconsistencies amongst those ages. And I think, Chair, it would be helpful at some stage to look at that in general. The issue of consulting, yes, we as MPs go out, but Jalifa Imam is a DNA 10, 20 years. And so it's a combination, Chair. I think we're with you. We as MPs need to go out there, but also need to value what the Imam is saying and his experience there over 10, 20 years. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Bassett, the EU will help us. You know, yesterday the advocates from the Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference said, why don't we lower the age to 10 and say 10 to 16? And I actually didn't agree with him. But I was later persuaded to say, if we say children between 12 and 16 will engage in this activity, who say that children between 10 and 11 would not do the same? And if they can do the same, what are we saying about that? But for me, the interest was, are we bound by the Constitutional Court to
to lower the age only depends. And if we are persuaded that maybe 12 was conservative or progressive, shouldn't we go down to 10? Maybe it's an academic question, but I think I understood it also in the sense that the advocate was saying Parliament also has its authority. The court has instructed us to say 12 to 16. But if the presenters convince us that maybe we must even go lower than 12, are we, in terms of that condition, entitled to do so? But maybe it's academic. But can you express yourself on that, or you want to sleep to that?
My colleague Ying Tree and myself discussed that last night, and it is one of the things that we're going to have to consider. I don't want to come up with an answer right now, if you don't mind, but it is something that we are going to come back to this committee on, having a look at the legal implications. I don't know whether Mr. Dupria would like to add to it. Can I think it would be dangerous for me to try and even provide an answer now. Can we come back to it? We have certainly thought about it, and it's something that we would like to look at. It's the possibility of lowering it. There's a possibility of increasing the age, and we want to see what those implications will, or if we go one of those routes, what would be the would it be in line with the Constitutional Court's judgment? And that's what we would like to consider more carefully, and I would be hesitant now to serve.
I'm actually very happy about that, because in the back of my mind, and standing in the shoes of the presenters, I was just saying, won't the presenters say, why worry to come and appear before this parliamentary committee if they are expected just to rubber stamp? But the fact that our highly qualified lawyers listen to that concern and they slept over it and they still want to do more work, I think should say to you that this parliament and this government take very seriously your submission, and we'll wait for them to come back with us.
A paragraph in the judgment whilst they're considering it. And I ask them to look at paragraph 3, where it says, it is also not about, it talks about the judgment, it is also not about whether Parliament may set a minimum age for consensual sexual conduct. So the book says we're not dealing with the minimum age. In other words, we as Parliament can deal. They're dealing with the decriminalisation from a constitutional avenue. And it's very clear, it says, it is not about whether children should or should not engage in sexual conduct. It is also not about whether Parliament may set a minimum age for consensual sexual conduct. The court didn't deal with it. We can set the age. That's a separate issue. Yeah. Up or down. Up or down. But clearly what the implications are then for future court cases is what I'd like the legal advisors to consider. And I think that's what you're asking. Thank you.
But is it developmentally actually beneficial and healthy? stance in the context of South Africa, you know, which I'm sure is appreciating very much.
That's the difficult thing, you all raised in the past, and obviously we come in from the future, but we know the reality on the ground, the law and the law has not come to the same, and the reality, and this is my case, and all this criminal action is not good. But we'll look forward to getting it better, because you all, at the end of the day, want to see what this is.
Thank you. I'm
Let's proceed. And just say to the officials of Parliament that from the discussion here, it's quite clear that we need the rural voice, and there's no one who can claim to be more representative of that voice than the Congress of Traditional Leaders of South Africa. We have also observed that we have many faith-based organizations, and that there's a need for an interfaith approach, and therefore it would be important that an organization like the National Interfaith Council of South Africa is invited to ensure that we accommodate as many faith-based organizations as possible, because if we were to invite them one by one, we would need the whole year to deal with the matter. But also, I see here we have the General Counsel of the Parliamentary Committee. I'm just wondering what's happening to attendees who are actually in touch with the families and the children. We have Black Lawyers Association, we have National Association of Democratic Lawyers. Where is their voice? We have Lawyers for Human Rights. Where are their voices? So I think we must check what the situation. How many days do we have, and when is the last day? Tuesday and Wednesday next week. So we really have an opportunity to approach those organizations, and I think they need to be here. I see the lady there, you conduct yourself as if you are representing one of the organizations I mentioned yourself. Where do you come from?
I come from the Legal Officer Center. We are
looking at. Oh, no, I'm not there. Okay, I see. I thought you maybe would come from VA or nothing.
No, I don't.
No, you are an important stakeholder. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Then I request you to address us or someone from your organization.
Good morning. Our submission. Our written submissions were sent through to the Portfolio Committee Secretary, and I think that we acknowledge that they are quite lengthy, and perhaps we're not going to go through them word for word. We do have 2 points that we want to focus on, and that's really what our submissions are focused on. So my colleague Malia Garira Mudarekwa, and I am Charlene May, and I'm just going to start off, and I will deal with the last section of the bill and the amendment dealing with the National Sex Offender Register.
Good morning. Thank you, Chair. As my colleague has already said, I'm going to specifically focus on the Tedbury case and our position on the Tedbury case. And again, we like to emphasize that we've limited our submissions to the extent to which the bill complied with the Constitutional Court order. And I think it's important to note from the beginning that this decision of the Tedbury case does not impact on the criminalization of non-consensual sex. Sexual conduct between children of any age, and it has also not impacted on sexual activity between children between 16 and 17, as well as children under 12 and under 15, as well as consensual sex between adults and children. Those criminalizations remain intact. Additionally, the case also does not change anything in regards to Section 57(1) of the Sexual Offences Act, that the first 6 days that children under 12 cannot consent for sex. So I think it's important to understand what it did and what it did not do, and the three things are important to know that they were not changed by the Constitutional Court. Some of the key findings of the Constitutional Court, I'm not going to repeat all of them because they've been discussed quite in some detail, but please note that the Constitutional Court found Section 15 and 16 of the Act to be unconstitutional in that it infringed the rights of children between 12 and 15 to dignity and privacy, and also violated their best interests as a trait in Section 8282 of the Constitution. And relying on expert evidence, the Constitutional Court concluded that this criminalization was criminalizing behavior that constitutes elementary normative conduct for adolescents. Therefore, in fact, it was actually hurting the children that it was supposed to protect. And lastly, the court therefore gave Parliament 18 months to review the Sexual Offences Act. So our position in terms of Section 2 and 3 of the bill are that they remove any possibility of criminalizing consensual sexual activity between children of 12 to and younger than 15. This is both statutory sexual violation and sexual sexual penetration. And we therefore support the fact that it completely removes any possibility of criminalization between consensual sexual activity between children of 12 to 15. Because we believe this is in line with both the Constitution as well as the Teddy Bear case order of the Constitutional Court. And in addition, there's also the closing age defense for exclusion. Some people are confused that there's a decision, defense for exclusion, but I think that's not really important. But what this exclusion does is say that if a person who's 12 and 15 engages in consensual sexual activity with a person between 16 and 17, they would not be prosecuted if the age difference, the person is at an age between 16 and 17, and the age difference between the two people is not more than 2 years. So essentially, if a 15 and a 16-year-old engage in consensual sexual activity, they will be able to use this closed age defense and will not be prosecuted. Again, we welcome this development because, again, we believe that it complies fairly with the order of the Constitution, of the Constitutional Court, as is the right place in the Constitution. The last point that I'd like to suggest is the issue in both Section 2 and 3 is an issue about delegation of prosecutorial discretion between when, for example, someone falls outside the closed age defense, that the DPP has the discretion to decide whether to prosecute that person or that child or not. I think this is very important because we have to remember that the Constitution says that trying the child is a person below 18. And even if we want to still prosecute when there's an age difference of over 2 years, we still want to ensure that the children are protected in terms of Section 28(2). And for example, if a 15-year-old and a 17.5-year-old engage in consensual sexual activity, the 17.5-year-old would they be criminalized? Would they be prosecuted? Because, technically speaking, they fall outside the closing age defense. And I think this, in our opinion, becomes the protection that is available for children. Because then it's not really nearly prosecution of anyone. It becomes protection in itself. So our position would then be that it must either be the National Director of Public Prosecutions or the Director of Public Prosecutions delegated to the NDP and delegated to the DPP. However, we don't think that this power can be. The opinion's form right now talks about delegation. It doesn't really say delegate to who and what are the parameters of the delegation. And we think that this delegation must be taken seriously because that in itself is a protection and change in the rule when there has to be consideration of whether children must be prosecuted or not. So in conclusion, we support the entrenchment decision to the 3 of the bill because they comply with the order of the Constitutional Court as well as the entrenchment of the Constitution. I hand over to my colleague to talk about the JK.
I suspect I'm going to be a bit longer. Okay. I'm going to start us off just by looking at the National Register of Sex Offenders and why it was established. The purpose of the register itself is really just to protect children and people with mental disabilities from coming into contact with sex offenders by informing relevant employers, licensing authorities, and child care authorities that a particular person is listed in the register.
the purpose, as I've explained, has serious implications. It really means that if your name appears on the register, you cannot be employed to work with children, hold a position related to supervision of the care of the child, or allow him or her access to a child, and the person cannot be granted a license or approval to manage a business or entity that cares for children, and lastly, cannot become a foster parent, a kinship caregiver, or even a temporary or safe care supervisory person. I'll now move on to the case of J versus MDPP, which was the case in the Constitutional Court that really gave rise to the amendments that we're looking at. The case in brief dealt with the conviction of a 14-year-old who was charged with the rape of a 7-year-old boy, 2 6-year-old girls, as well as assault GBH on another person. The main issue that came before the Constitutional Court was, because of the consequences and the impact of the inclusion of an offender's name in the register, the rights of the offender would be violated if that offender wasn't given adequate opportunity to put their case before the court, and if the court wasn't allowed discretion. The current framework of the Act does not allow the court to inquire and decide, after affording the accused an opportunity to make representation, whether the particulars of the accused should be included in the register. As we know, the High Court took the view of striking it down, both with adults and in respect of children, but only the issue of children was dealt with in respect of the Constitutional Court. And so we think it's important that we look at some of the key findings that would be useful in guiding the Portfolio Committee deciding on the proposed amendment that is before us in this book. The court looked at the best interest of the child and noted that a child's best interest of paramount importance in every matter concerning that child, that a child is capable of change, and that the child has a right to grow and to learn how they should conduct themselves and to make choices in the wide and moral world of adulthood. The law should distinguish how it deals with child and adult offenders. The court also emphasized the importance of an individual approach in saying that an individualized approach must be followed in respect of placing the name of a child offender on the list. So in general terms, we are happy that the bill does in fact comply with the essence of the key findings in the Constitutional Court. Our submission, if I can dwell on that a little bit, so our submission should move into the recommendations on how to better align the bill with the existing legislative framework that is contained in the Child Justice Act. By doing so, we believe the procedural aspects of the implementation of the bill will be a smoother process and less cumbersome on the child offender as well as the department that would be responsible for the implementation of the legislation. In particular, we look at Section 52A, and we advise that it should be amended to allow for the presiding officer to have the necessary discretion in deciding whether the name of the child offender is included on the register. In other words, there should be a presumption in favor of the child offender, and only if there are exceptional circumstances as deemed by the presiding officer should the name of the child be included. The word must that currently appears is still problematic in our reading, and we have suggested wording at page 22 of our submissions. If I go on, in terms of the Child Justice Act, there are provisions are made for pre-sentencing reports, which we suggest that as part of this process, the child offender is also evaluated to assess whether the name of the child should appear on the register. The presiding officer is therefore able to make an informed decision. So the basic process in the Child Justice Act is that there will be, when a child is convicted of an offense, a pre-sentencing report that is prepared. What we are suggesting is that as part of that process, the person doing the assessment does a relevant assessment on whether or not it would be in the child's best interest and looking at some of the key guidelines as to whether or not the child's name should be placed on the register. Again, we have suggested some wording that can be found on page 22 of our submission. I now turn to the issue of removal from the register. Again, we welcome the amendment which now places the removal from the register of a child offender before court, as opposed to one of the earlier or previous grounds. We do believe it's critical, however, for the presiding officer to be in a position where he or she can make an informed decision that balances the rights of the child offender as well as the risk to the survivor of the crime, as well as other children, as well as mentally disabled persons.
We would suggest that guidelines be developed that can be used to guide a presiding officer in making a determination. Such guidelines must not fall into our legislation, and guidelines have been developed as an example to assist presiding officers in implementing legislation such as the Domestic Violence Act. We believe that these guidelines will be important to ensure that issues around the removal from the register of a child offender does not become a merely administrative or academic issue, but that the child's rights are balanced. The Child Justice Act would come into effect once a child enters the criminal justice system. And so we again recommend utilizing and extending some of its provisions in respect of monitoring the behavior of the child offender, assessing the risk that the child offender might pose, but also make a recommendation.
I have one
more page. I can do that in 2 minutes. So what we're really proposing is that certain clauses and certain sections of the Child Justice Act can be looked at and incorporated so that it provides sufficient protection for the child while the child is within the system, as well as when the child's name needs to be removed from the register. Again, we have suggested wording that can be found on page 24 of our submissions. Again, I want to emphasize the point that the removal of child offender from the register does not become a purely administrative process where rights and interests of the child is not taken into account, as well as balancing the rights of children and people with mental disabilities, which the register seeks to protect. Again, I refer to relevant or suggested wording that can be found on page 25 of our submissions. Thank you very much.
Honourable Chair, my name is Leika Sudar. I am the representative here to present the Commission on behalf of the Women's Legal Centre.
Forget, so forgive me.
Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, the Women's Legal Centre welcomes the opportunity to make oral submissions to the Portfolio Committee, and we express our gratitude to the Committee for the opportunity and for the extension of the deadline for the written submissions. At the outset, I'd just like to state out that with regard to the structure of our submissions, we're going to be dealing with two core issues. Firstly, the consensual sexual activity between adolescent peers. In this regard, we're dealing with the rationale for the Women's Legal Centre support for decriminalisation of consensual sexual activity between adolescents, and we're also going to be talking about the extent to which the bill complies with the Constitutional Court judgment in the Teddy Bear matter. We will secondly be dealing with child sex offenders and the National Register of Sex Offenders, and in this regard we're going to be raising issues of particular concern to the Women's Legal Centre. If I'm at the outset, just provide with a very broad overview with regard to the type of work that we do. The Women's Legal Centre is a non-governmental organisation. Our core objective is to advance and protect the human rights of women in South Africa. We celebrated our 15th year in existence, and in terms of our core mandate, we are involved in constitutional and impact litigation on behalf of women and girls that promotes and protects women's rights to advance gender equality in South Africa. In this regard, we participate in a number of precedent-setting cases relating to women's human rights, specifically with regard to gender-based violence, health and property rights, access to land and housing, as well as resources within relationships. Our litigation is also supported by our advocacy work, and we also provide a free legal advice service to women nationally from our Cape Town and Johannesburg offices and through a satellite office in Khayelitsha. We assist clients nationally also through telephonic queries that we may receive and by email queries as well. With regard to the issue of consensual sexual activity between adolescent peers,
We just wanted to point out that the Women's Legal Center acted as an amicus curiae or friend of court in the Teddy Bear matter that was both at the High Court and also at the Constitutional Court hearing of the matter. And in both forums, we made submissions on the disproportionate effects of Section 15 and 16 of the Act on adolescent girls specifically. We are in full agreement with the Constitutional Court's reasoning and a judgment in the matter. That said, however, there are a couple of points that we thought it would be useful to raise for the purpose of context before dealing with the specific proposed amendments. Firstly, we'd like to say that, bearing in mind that South Africa has high level of sexual violence, we do understand that the brunt of the sexual violence in this country is indisputably borne by women. That said, however, sexual violence against girl children cannot be conflated with consensual sexual exploration and activity between adolescent peers. The second point of importance is that decriminalization does not amount to encouragement of adolescent sexual activity. While it's not necessarily desirable for adolescents to engage in a full range of consensual sexual activity with one another, the criminal justice system is simply not the appropriate response or mechanism to teach healthy sexual behavior and decision-making to adolescents. We believe that subjecting adolescents to the criminal justice system for engaging in sexual activity that is consensual can have the effect of significantly harming them psychologically and emotionally, and it also has the potential to separate adolescents from the people, places, and services that would afford them protection and allow them to learn and understand healthy sexual behavior and responsibility. The next point that we'd like to make is with regard to the rights that are implicated in respect of the included provisions. The Constitutional Court has found that Sections 15 and 16 of the Act infringe on the adolescent's right to human dignity, privacy, and the best interests of the child. As a result, the Constitutional Court did not consider it necessary to deal with the other alleged rights infringements which were raised and which the Women's Legal Center did raise before the court. Two of them are the right to equality, the girl-child right to bodily integrity, and the right of access to health care services. I'm going to touch on these very briefly just for the purpose of providing context. With regard to the right to equality, it's primarily adolescent girls, not boys, who are going to be the victims of and lay charges in respect of non-consensual sexual offences like rape and sexual assault. The challenge with the imputed provisions in their current form is where there's a lack of consent on the part of the complainant girl, and that cannot be proved. The complainant girl has to then be charged under Sections 15 and 16 because the provision calls for both parties to the sexual activity be charged if prosecution is in fact authorized. The effect of the imputed provisions on the girl child is that someone who starts out as a complainant in a rape matter might end up becoming a co-perpetrator for a sexual offense. With regard to the right of bodily integrity and access to healthcare services, we believe that by virtue of the criminalization of consensual adolescent sexual conduct and the reporting requirements that are contained in Section 54, this could result in diminished health seeking in the context of sexual and reproductive health. This poses specific concerns with regard to failure to obtain contraception and other reproductive and health services primarily accessed by girl children. The last bit that we'd like to make is with regard to discrimination on the grounds of sex, it is only girl children who fall pregnant and bear the visual marker of sexual intercourse. This physical marker has already resulted in the selective investigation and arbitrary prosecution of pregnant girls, and as a result discriminates against girl children on the grounds of sex. So in circumstances, the Women's Legal Center welcomes the proposed amendments to clauses 1, 2, and 3 of the bill. We support them broadly, and we support the progress made in complying with the decision of the court in the Teddy Bear matter. If I may just touch on the provisions, clauses 1, 2, and 3 very specifically. Firstly, as I mentioned, we welcome the decriminalization of consensual sexual penetration and violation. We also welcome the closing age exclusion of criminal liability for 16 and 17-year-olds. That said, however, our concerns relate to the manner in which the decision to prosecute is currently being dealt with. In this regard, we submit that the discretion should probably lie at the highest possible being with the National Director of Public Prosecutions. If I may very quickly just take you through the current clauses of the bill. With regards to the amendment to clause 1, the definition of the child, the Women's Legal Center is in full support of this definition. With regard to, or rather the amendment to this definition, with regard to clause 2, while we support the amendments to clause section 15(1) of the Act, as they are in keeping with the judgment of the Constitutional Court, and while we also welcome the close in age exclusion of criminal liability, you know, in order to allow for adolescents not have to be subjected to the criminal justice system arbitrarily, we, however, do not support the provisions as they are in the amended form relating to the discretion to prosecute. While we don't object to the retention of the discretion to prosecute, we are concerned about the reassigning of the discretion to prosecute to the relevant directors of public prosecutions instead of the National Director of Public Prosecutions. The rationale for lowering the level of decision-making is unclear. It's also unclear how it is that this lowering will best serve the interests of children between, of 16 and 17 years of age. We also do not support the amendment which allows the discretion to prosecute 16 and 17-year-olds to be delegated. Here again, we don't believe that this is in the best interest of those children. Similar comments can be made with regard to Clause 3 of the Amendment Act with regard to acts of consensual violation with certain children. This is related to the amendments to Section 16 of the Act. Here again, we support the amendments to Section 16(1). However, with regard to Section 16(2)(a), we do not support the decision again to reassign discretion to the various directors of public prosecution as opposed to the National Director of Public Prosecution. Here again, I'd just like to reiterate what we stated with regard to Section 15 in this regard. The last point that I'd like to deal with is with the extent to which the bill complies with the Constitutional Court's judgment in the matter of J versus National Director of Public Prosecutions. So I'd just like to raise a few issues of particular concern to the Women's Legal Center. And I say this because we support and endorse the submissions and recommendations of the Center for Child Law and the Community Law Center, who have dealt with these provisions and the extent to which they comply with the J case in a great amount of detail in the submissions. As a result, I'm not going to be canvassing the specific technical points raised. I do, however, wish to take the opportunity to state that our particular concern over the impugned provisions relates to the practical impact on adult children. Let me provide you with a contextual example. When a child takes or shares a sexually explicit photograph of herself, this would constitute the manufactured possession and distribution of child pornography. This would allow for the child to then be placed and have their name entered in the National Register for Sex Offenders. Well, this is challenging because particularly young girls are socially encouraged to be sexually attractive and as a result to create and share sexually explicit photographs and videos of themselves. These girl children are not child pornographers in any real sense of the word, but have technically made themselves guilty of the manufactured possession and distribution of child pornography and are then liable to automatically have their names recorded in the National Register of Sex Offenders. This is not in the best interest of girl children or children in general to automatically have their names recorded in the register. We submit that the unintended consequences of the provisions around the register have to be carefully considered, particularly in light of the irrational manner in which the provisions can play out in practical reality, and bearing in mind the harmful consequences for children in general and girl children in particular. In the circumstances and in conclusion, I'd just like to say that we are in general support of clauses 1 to 3 of the bill, barring, however, the submissions we need regarding the discretion to prosecute. However, with regard to clauses 4 to 10 of the bill, we believe that they still fall short of compliance with the principles of the best interests of the child, as set out in the Constitution, as well as in the J matter, and we submit that these clauses then require further consideration as well as reformulation. I thank you for the opportunity to make submissions on the board here.
Mr. Piccolo, Mr. Piccolo, the artist, very few family lives, and have you seen the label where you go?
Yes, I can make a clarity on this. I think we have, this is a reference to the Eastern Cape. Then we have submitted a analysis campaign, Rescue Family Lives. Then we received the acknowledgement by an email that says the organization has been selected. We must give two names. So give two names. So that's why this, I don't know if it did appear to the lady, but he did give us the confirmation.
Yes.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. The same thing happened. There was a lady called Ayanda Ngwane who made a submission to the committee and confirmation sent by Cindy Bailey to make the representation, and she sent me on behalf of that organization to make an input.
No, we have no problem. We want to listen to it.
Okay.
We very well present to you, but the rule applies that we are going to take questions for the two legal organizations, and then we are the next. Honorable members, you have heard this very eloquent women's presentation. If you are persuaded, you can also just compliment them. But if we have questions for clarity, we are free to raise.
Honorable Sir. Thank you, Jay. Jay, to the Women's Legal Center, there was a very insightful comment that really got me thinking, and that is in terms of our present law, where a young girl lays charge of rape, adolescence, against another older boy, and she can't prove that she did not give consent. But in terms of our present law, she then can be charged, as I understand it correctly. And that is obviously a rape concern from our side. So we really need everyone to understand that is an implication of the existing law. Where a rape victim, we can't prove that she did not give consent. In fact, then they say, well, you consented. She then can also be charged. In terms of existing law, prior to the court case, so that gives added substance to why it's important to look very carefully at the legislation. Can I just ask the Women's Legal Center to help me with understand another issue, and that is, conversely, at the moment, and we appreciate the court has given an order that we are bound by, but conversely, a child cannot, because it's criminalized, a young victim cannot give consent. When the bill is passed and is decriminalized, she will then, as I understand the legal position, to be able to give consent. So where she lays a charge of rape, similarly, and the elder child perpetrator then says, but you consented, and she then has to disprove consent again. Because at the moment, a criminalized, and she can't give consent. You understand that correctly? In other words, she then has to go to court and disprove consent. And that is a major issue, because we know one of the reasons of the high sexual rates in our country and is that only 1 in 10 rape cases are reported. And the Act says it's to prevent secondary trauma of having to give evidence. Now, it's a difficult issue to deal with because the court has said we've got to decriminalize. But do you agree with me that that is an implication of the decriminalization, is that in such situations that younger girl, as you point out, but it could be a younger boy then as well, would have to go to court to disprove consent and the onus. Because they're lawyers, Chair, this issue came up from your colleague yesterday. You remember Advocate Mpuwang raised it. But they're lawyers, they'll understand. The onus of proof is then on the young girl, on the state, to prove lack of consent. Whereas at the moment, the issue of consent is not an issue because it is criminalized. And does that not open children into a greater degree of sexual vulnerability, something that we wish to avoid? If that is the case, how do we deal with that? Thank you.
And GCP, maybe they can help me as well.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Honorable Member, with regard to the question of consent, specifically with regard to the issue of a lack of consent, at the end of the day, the proposed amendments to the piece of legislation specify that if the child commits an act of sexual penetration with a child who is 12 years of age or older, but under the age of 16 years, you know, they, despite consent, there is an offence that's been committed unless the other child was 12 years of age or older, but under the age of 16 years. So in talking about a much older child, we also need to bear in mind the different age groups that we're talking about, because we also have a situation where we've got 16 or 17-year-old children who then have the closing age gap, the provision dealing with the closing age gap in relation to them. That said, however, in circumstances where there is a lack of consent, where a girl child has to come forward and claim that she had engaged, that another child had engaged in sexual penetration with her and that she did not provide consent, that falls really within the ambit of what is currently covered by rape in this country. And at the end of the day, she would still be able to go through the process of laying a charge of rape against the person against whom she's claiming did not give consent prior to engaging in the act of sexual penetration. My apologies, Chair, I'm not entirely always causing interference on this line. Thank you, Chair.
Sorry to follow up, but I understand that. The issue relates to statutory rape, which we are, where no issue of consent is involved. And that is the problem that we face within society. Why, in many cases, one can't get a rape conviction is because of the issue of consent, particularly with young children, that they cannot give evidence about the whole issue of consent. So at the moment, the statutory rape, I'm talking about, say, a 12-year-old and 15-year-old who's 15 and 3/4, who alleges, and it's a familial situation, in a school, in a gangster situation or something, the kid was raped, and at the moment, she charges the person with rape. She can't disprove the fact that she says, I never gave consent. At least at the present situation, you could fall back on what you call statutory rape and get a conviction, as opposed to at the moment where the person would get away scot-free. So I fully appreciate that the child could lay a rape charge, but it's all a fallback position or a competent verdict to get a conviction on statutory rape. I'm sure the presenter will agree with me that then falls away as a consequence of the decriminalisation, and that is something we have to live with. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think so the issue with statutory offences, statutory rape or statutory violation, is that it's irregardless of consent. It doesn't matter. So if they're 12 and 15 and up, right? So technically speaking, the closing age exclusion doesn't apply. So technically speaking, the prosecutor can go squarely on statutory rape or statutory violation. And this is where, but because there's a child involved, that's where section 16.2A MB would apply. Similarly for section 16.2A would also apply, right? Where the prosecutor would have discretion to say, we'll prosecute the child or not for statutory rape or not. But all these things fall away. If the child, the same exact age is again, if the child, the person reporting says, I was raped, right, then the issue of consent becomes the center of it all, regardless of whether the closing age defenses apply or not. Because remember, as I said in my presentation, this bill does not tie on issues where there's no consent. So unfortunately, that is part, it becomes like any rape case. That consent, the state has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that consent was not given. And I don't think that's an issue that's only unique to children's cases. There is some arguments. There have been cases where the DCP have revoked and withdrawn cases or dismissed cases because they're children and they're not able to testify and so forth. I think that may be an additional issue that needs to be ventilated. That's why there are all vision rooms and in the court sexual offences makes provision for how children can testify in camera and all of that. And maybe there's a reluctance to try and explore the mechanism to ensure that children can testify.
it's an issue that happens in mostly in all the cases, that consent would then have to be proven that it was not given. Thank you.
I agree with you, but your argument is very convincing. It's very convincing. I had something like a not an individual, because if we talk about an individual and we say only that individual should decide, are we not running the risk that he won't be able to manage the case load, and therefore we have backlogs which are really going to create some problems? Can we address us on it? Who raised that issue?
Thank you, Honorable Chi. With regard to our motivation for having the National Director of Public Prosecutions exercise the discretion not to have it delegated or dealt with by individual directors of public prosecution, here our concern is the need for consistency on a national level in dealing with prosecution of 16 and 17-year-old children. Bearing in mind that this is crucial because we deal here with children under the age of 18, so the best interest of the child provision in the Constitution, in terms of Section 28, requires us to ensure that their best interests are held as paramount. The potential impact on the lives of children who have experienced experienced the criminal justice system means that we need to ensure that any attempts and decisions that are made to make a determination on prosecution has to be consistent nationally. We can't ensure consistency nationally in circumstances where individual directors of public prosecutions are exercising their discretion, more so in circumstances where the discretion is not stated in the Act or in the proposed amendment. Thank you, Chair.
While we agree with our colleagues, we were concerned exactly with what you're saying, that sometimes there's delays because, you know, there are other things that take priority. And our concern was the issue of access to justice in speedy trials. And we were of the opinion that it should generally be given to the National Director of Public Prosecution, who can delegate only to the Director of Public Prosecution. But however, there should also be guidelines as to what are they considering in this prosecutorial discretion. Why I say this is, for example, we talk about the issue of minimum sentences where certain conviction is applied. There's no discretion right now where judges are taking things like, oh, this child needs to take, so we're going away from that. So I think that there must still be guidelines, detailed guidelines that says, because of the best interest of the child, certain things must apply or must, you know, very at the very least is what you consider and what you don't consider. So that even if it goes from the National Director of Public Prosecution to the Director of Public Prosecution, there is still consistency and there's still rights of the children protected. That's our position. Thank you, Chair.
I think that the guidelines are important, and also it's better to have a collective working on issues so that the absence of one person doesn't collapse the entire system. So the delegation also, I think, is important, but your concerns are legitimate, and then we're going to weigh them against other considerations. Can we then move on to the family rescue?
Thank you, Sherifin, for this opportunity. I think let me make this clarity that since Cindy is not here, maybe our documents are not printed or not, but I would apologize that the submission can also be made here, leave it, or email, because I believe he put it made under my name, not under the yes. Thank you very much. Before, I just wanted, when I was raising a hand at the time, I wanted to concur with the Honourable Member, Mr. Steve, that when you mentioned the issue of the people in the rural, I'm from the Eastern Cape, whereby when the laws or the bills are passed, they don't know anything about them, but they always reap the fruits. What do I mean when they always reap the fruits? For the case he made about the abortion thing, the minister has clearly attacked Minister Aaron Motsoaledi that the girls now are doing this for preventative measures many a times. And last, it is statistically that we have lost about 90 kids a year, every year, statistics, who are being aborted. So those kids that are aborting or those children that are aborting, they are probably having whereby they cannot even bear child anymore because of the continuous abortion. Maybe they do it two times, three times. You go to the Eastern Cape, you find this thing. And I think now we are reaping the amendment bill or the bill of abortion, but it's coming negatively to us. So, and as the race to family life, we have a concern on this matter of the bill. We understand that as it said, that the definition of a child is the age of 18 years in section 1A. So I took it under that perspective that a child is less than 18 years. That is a child. Because in South Africa, many documents are signed by an 18-year-old person to show his or her ability of adulthood or maturity. Therefore, with regards to the bill, it is clear that the concern is that the issue of conviction of children that they will be written on the criminal offences or register. So we cannot deny the problem that the children commit themselves to sexual activity. Hence the amendment prevents them from having criminal charges against themselves. Maybe they were in agreement of that. They wanted to affect the concern to each other. So I just made a little research on the issue of the early childhood sexual intercourse. The Dr. Fred Maxis Bush has made it clear as a clinical instructor that it affects children. Sex affects children health-wise, intellectually, and the social responsibility are very affected. That could result on the pain and suffering from broken relationships, fear, confusion about romantic feelings, altered self-esteem, sense of betrayal and abandonment, guilt, depression and emotional roller coaster, impaired ability to form healthy long-term relationships. Therefore, we have some recommendations about this, that let us seek to that definition of a child, that says a child is less than 18 years, that is a constitutional matter. Then, if the child is below 18 years, then they must not be allowed to consent for sexual related matters, and they are liable to sign many official documents. They even vote. They don't even vote if they're less than 18. So, if you talk about sex, sex is done privately. So, that we know that if they are found, in most cases, if they are found or there is a case laid, that's when we can say we deal with that case. But we recommend that the mercy counseling centers that should be established for any cases of children engaging in such consensual sex activity to avoid them being registered on the National Register for sex offenders because they are still matured, immature. And the last one, the parents, that they should take full responsibility for their children's offenses if they are the trustees of God. The Bible tells us that a child has been bred by a mother and father. So that simply means the person that to be trusted to the child who has to give consent is a parent until a certain age. That is, we need to focus on that one. So that is what we are recommending as the young people. So I'm from the very rural areas. Down when you talk about this, they don't even know Even the issue of the traditional leaders, you can call them, they don't understand, because there is no enough, even us, you are lucky because you are in a town to get internet and be able to Google the things and have, but the majority are there in the rural areas and many of them are affected. So, and we are saying this has to be taken into consideration, involvement of parents. And thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, to the Honourable Members of Parliament, and to everyone that's here, good afternoon, after 12. Also from the Eden Cape, it's not a collusion with Ms. Bailey, I must be frank with you, but I think it's just one of those things that statistically happens, where she picks people and they all so happen to be from the same region. My name, and I'm a young woman who currently resides in the former homeland of the Transkei, and I was really saddened when I read about the efforts of what's happening now with this new bill and the amendment of the bill that's coming forth. In consultation with many women, what you see is that it is women who suffer greatly from where we are from. And even in 2015, this hasn't changed. Presently, you see the circumstances around which many young women encounter, especially in rural communities. I'm going to explain briefly why I think this amendment need not be changed as is currently proposed. Especially reducing the age of sexual consent. We're even hearing today that there's proposition to potentially go to beyond even what the Constitutional Court has proposed, to even go beyond that and even make it lower, which for me is quite startling, I must be honest. If the issue at hand is criminal record given to youngsters, why reduce the age and not deal with the issue of the record itself? I'm not a lawyer, and I think we've got very intelligent women who've been speaking on behalf of the legal amendments that can be done. But the issue I'm posing is, why not deal with the issue of the record? But why do you have to reduce the age if you want to deal with the record, deal with the record of the youngster, but not change the age of consent for sex? My firm belief is that we should rather focus on the corrective and restorative justice for those youths who are found to be guilty of breaking that law, not put the lives of millions of other young people at the mercy of a society that is currently now grappling with teenage pregnancy, undetected sex among adults, despite millions being spent by our departments, provincial government, and other Love Life campaigns on efforts to reduce this. Little has changed the behavior of our people and our young people. Women are constantly raped. There's statistics in various documents from government that are produced by various institutions. I'm not going to go into them, and I think some people have already alluded to them. It's a problem in the country. But we have been unable to contain adult sexual behavior. Yet millions of rants and campaigns are constantly being done. And HIV is the highest rate in the world. It exceeds India with a population of 1.23 billion. We only have 52 million people. There is a problem in our society. And we now want to allow children to have no hindrances, no barriers. And if adults cannot contain themselves, condomize and do what is required as adults. And now we want children to have the onus and the responsibility that adults cannot bear. And we are not taking these things into account. I believe that we're making a great error as a country and the government if we do these things. I'm speaking to a young African girl child, and I'm saying that she's further exposed in a society if this law and amendment is taken in its current form. I vehemently oppose such and believe that these amendments, including sex with young men or women under the age of 16, can and should not be encouraged by the government, and it would be a grave mistake if the government continues along this trajectory. I'll give some facts and sites and papers that have been commissioned by the government itself. A child who's 12, 13, 14, 15, even 16 can make a mistake in the events leading up to, during, and even after sex, as children are expected to be their children. If the child between the age of 12 and 15 does get pregnant, it has been proven by Pandey and Makiwane et al., who wrote a very nice piece for what is called Human Science Research Council in 2009, a research document commissioned by the Department of Basic Education titled Teenage Pregnancy in South Africa with a specific focus on school-going learners. They say that only a third of those who are pregnant go back to school. So two out of three actually never go back. That's a fact. I'm not talking to you here about what I feel. But the statistics, I believe, in rural areas will be far worse. Why I'm saying that is because of the system and the cultural prevalences that are prevalent there.
the one who will be most affected is the South African girl child who is in the rural areas. Their re-entrance into school will be further aggravated because there will be no support available to that girl. There is no support for them. And the shunned upon, that young girl, not the young man's future, is put on hold forever. The second reason I'm opposing this bill is the situation around teenage pregnancy is worse than rural provinces. A recent document, the same paper by the HSRC that was commissioned by the Department of Education, showed that there's a high concentration of teenage donor pregnancies in the Eastern Cape, in KZN, and in Limpopo. You'll note that the economic disparities in these provinces, they're largely rural. We may be speaking for urban cities where people think the cultural prevalences are quite different. In the rural areas, you see statistics show different different practices. But the result of some of these things are more prevalent. One of the factors is that where poverty remains unacceptably high, we put the lives of young rural women at higher risk for pregnancy. Why I'm saying that is because the poverty cut occurs in areas where there is high unemployment, significant low incomes, or high reliance on state or law support. Now, in these areas, young women do not have the power to decide how and under what condition they will have sex. It is a man's role in those areas, and it is likely that the girl child will have no say as to how it will happen. Mr. Black raised an issue here about will you not further compromise the right of those girl children if they have to now further prove at the age of 12 that they were raped and they had no consent. It's hard to get an 18-year-old or 24-year-old to go to court and make this proof. How much more for a young girl at 12? I think that would be a travesty. Disempowered and without voice, it is likely that she may contract even an STI, HIV, and even get pregnant should the boy, child, or a man refuse to use the condom. Now, the Department of Health did a national HIV and syphilis prevalence survey in South Africa in 2008. Statistics show that 12.9% of girl child between 15 and 19 who are pregnant also contract HIV. Fact. Children do not have the mental and physical and psychological development necessary to understand how to use contraception. They cannot make mature decisions. They have not yet reached maturity until the early 20s. Now, I'm raising this because we need to look at the bill and the impact of the bill. No one is talking about what could be the negative implication of this bill. Everyone is talking about the amendments of the bill and what you can do legalistically and how you should do the amendments. What about the impact this bill is going to have? One of the propositions I'm making that I'll recommend at end is the government or the parliament has researches and budgets that they can actually look at in the effecting of this bill. What is the likely impact on the fiscus? I looked at the amendment proposed. It says the financial implication, none. I don't believe there will be none. I think that research needs to be done. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding what is written on that amendment. But we need to look what really will the financial impact on the state. Can the state afford further children who leave school at 12, 13, 14? Remember, two-thirds will leave, not come back to school. Who's going to be the burden? Finance them through grants or EPW programs, we have to give the money to state support. Who's bearing that tax burden, the taxpayer? There is a cost to kids who leave school before they're supposed to leave school. There's also another fiscal cost to young girls who don't actually, who are not enabled to complete their schooling. There is a great cost to the state already on grants. I'm not going to go into the statistics. There's lots of numbers on what proportion of our budget are spent on social and state bonds. So we want to create a society that's more dependent and children that are highly dependent on the state and further exacerbating the fiscus where the money is actually not there given the current economic and fiscal situation that this country is in. I don't think we should. So I think that we need to look at some of these issues. One of the things that I did a lot of research when I was making these inputs and in the deliberations, there's a survey that was done looking at the South African youth risk behavior. It's called the RHRU survey. And they look at the way in which young people use condoms. One of the arguments that is made is, oh, young children can, you know, they play around, they experiment, they can do all these things, and they can just be educated through life orientation, you know, they will use condoms. The fact is, according to the survey, again, commissioned by the state, cited again by two different papers, William S. 2013, who wrote a review of teenage pregnancy in South Africa, experiences of schooling, knowledge, and access to sexual and reproductive health services, reported commissioned by a research group called Partners in Sexual Health. They found that one young woman who are poor sometimes have to make trade-offs between health and economic insecurity, which can lead to extreme abuse of relationships, intergenerational relations, multiple partners, etc., etc. The list goes on. The KZN Department of Health has even gone first to pilot the campaign, the Scourge of Sugar Daddy, which is prevalent in some of these societies. And learners who fall into this trap is because poverty sometimes drives young girls into these situations. How do these amendments of this law then deal with this current societal issue that we are grappling with as a country that we have not been able to find solutions to? I believe the amendment of the bill is going to worsen the situation for these girl children. The unintended consequences of this bill will most certainly be more teenage pregnancies, even though we have heard some of the arguments today stating that it will not increase. It will not increase. But the mind of children, if you ask the mind of a learner, what happens if this thing is allowed? Talk to children at schools and find out if there is a preventative measure or what I call a boundary that is set for children. Children want and need boundaries. And I think as a country, we need to not put a law that says boundaries having levels made. You know, when you were raised as a child and your mother said, don't do something, and they said, no, don't put your hand in the oven, you're going to get burnt. I mean, I'm using a very simplistic example. But there was a reason for that, because if you do put your hand in the oven, you will get burnt. If children have sex at the age of 12, they may get pregnant, they may contract STI, they may contract even HIV, they may school. There's all these things that they now are putting in commas, get burnt by, and it's not just now an issue of their personal lives. It's the issue of the budget, the fiscus, the state, their families. There's so many implications, and I think we really need to look cohesively at that as the people of South Africa, and I think Parliament needs to really look at the financial and the fiscal implication thereof before just looking just only at the legal and the constitutionality thereof. And lastly, the law assumes sex to be a mere physical act, yet it's an emotional, spiritual, and a physical act. It's one that can impact the self-esteem of teenagers. And I cite a child psychologist who mentions that children, teenagers, according to a research, they break up within 6 months of dating. They kiss. The impact on these children is likely to be depression, sometimes leading to suicide, abandonment, and low self-esteem. Definitely a holistic view of the world needs to be taken into account. So one of the discussions we had is how are we making recommendations around these clauses 1 to 5. My recommendation is that corrective and restorative justice must take place. Please, can we not lower the age even to below 12, even take it up if necessary with the advocates who have all the legal minds and understanding of the legalities. So if it can't it be increased from 12 to take it even higher rather than taking it lower, given how you are putting the child at risk, at further risk, because they don't have a mental capacity to understand the impact of having sex at that young age. Why do we not disciple learners on the virtues of purity or waiting to have sex later? I think the Muslim Judicial Council was mentioning this. Why don't we have programs at schools that educate children to wait for later? Out of our own teachers, why are we going to school giving kids condoms? Why don't we teach them to wait? Why is that not being taught? I'm putting this as a matter for debate. And encourage young people to get educated. Why does the government, I'm now being slightly, perhaps Dr. Mustafa can give me input. Why does the government not give incentive for young children who pass the matric? We give incentive for children who have babies. We give them grants. Why do we not give a grant to children who pass the matric and do those kind of things? And yeah, that those are my inputs. Yeah, thank you.
You know, I trust what you say. You are still watching the state to do what society is doing. And you know, you also say that society has failed. Now these people who are in the state cannot be more concerned about their children than their parents. Because these people went to school, they passed their certificates, when they went to go to work, they went for a job, and they want to pay it, and they want increases. But it takes responsibility from society. You know, we say that it takes a village to raise a child, which means that there's a collective responsibility in the village, in the family, extended family, to deal with this issue. Make them conservative and keep quiet and listen to others who are not conservative like me. Honorable Schwartz, I see Honorable Horn is still applying his mind to these matters.
Chair, thank you, and thank you for the input, and thank you for the passion. Actually, we need to hear the passion from rural areas. And I think the last speaker spoke about the issue of disempowered young women. And that's a very important key, because some of the research I've done is that there are some areas, and I say the greatest respect, where young girls do not know they can say no. And I'd ask whether we can come from that, because of that disempowerment. So now we're passing a law allowing that, assuming with a decriminalization, that a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old can understand the consequences of consenting to full penetrative sex. We are hearing that due to disempowerment of young women, young girls, that are not in a position to even give that consent. And that is an issue. But I agree with you, it's a societal issue, but it is also government responsibility, as the court has pointed out. But there is a role for state, because of the teenage pregnancies, HIV AIDS, there's a legitimate important role that the state plays. So it's a combination, it's a partnership, and I think we all agree with that. Society must play a role. But I also like the suggestion of the consideration, because the court has said it is not dealing with the minimum age of consent. It is dealing with decriminalization. There's nothing to prevent us lifting the age as well. And a number of people have indicated that that is something we could consider. If you have, for example, the age of puberty in our common law is 14, why do we have it that a 12-year-old boy can consent to having sex with another 12-year-old boy? Surely that's not. And we understand the Constitution in that, but does a 12-year-old understand the long-term implications of that? And so, Chair, those are issues that we can debate as we're going on.
Saying a 12-year-old can consent to a 12-year-old, or I would say it does happen that the two at that age have sex, and that, therefore, would not criminalize.
Chair, I think you're correct. You're correct. And from a legal, straight legal perspective, decriminalization, if you decriminalization, a child cannot be prosecuted. But what is the sense on the ground when you say that? And that, if we could get to every individual member of the population and explain what the term decriminalization means, that's something different. But the perception I'm concerned about is that children will then think they are permitted to do it. And as we've raised it in previous meetings, if you say it's decriminalized, people will be given to understand that it means they can engage in that. And that is a challenge for us as lawmakers, Chair. The last point is, when we pass a bill, we have to pass it. And that has not been done. And I think it's very important, some of the financial implications that have been highlighted and the unintended consequences for fiscus are issues that also need to be in mind. So I think we've been given a lot to think about with these last two submissions, Chair. And I've asked today for it in writing. I don't think we received it in writing, so that we can get that at a later stage. Thank you, Chair.
You know, I tried to read grade 6 mathematics, and I asked me the mathematics metric. Each time I tried to do, trying to help the child, I got it wrong. And now I said to myself, this kid must be more advanced than me. So, which means our children have the capacity to understand. but the parents are not doing their work to educate the children. I think, no, the reason I want to be out of order is so that you can correct me. Yes. Allow me to be out of order so that you can help me. I'm saying, we cannot say the children lack the capacity to understand. I think as parents and as teachers and as society, we are not doing enough to educate the children. And I'll tell you why I say this. I interact a lot with the traditional communities. I've been in KZN, I've been in the Popo, I've been in the Northwest. I find that those communities have ways to address these questions. And that's why I support this idea that we must allow the Congress of Traditional Leaders to be here and tell them our experience. Because every royal family has a queen mother, and these queen mothers over age have been addressing this. For instance, I would say I'm civilized, my children must have eggs for breakfast, and the traditional people say no, girls should not eat eggs, and say they're oppressing girls. But if you give girls children eggs, they develop breasts, and the next thing, they want something else. So we need to look at the situation in its totality. I will suspend any judgment. I have no judgment. I just want to make sure that everybody has enough opportunity to contribute. So you can proceed on my case.
Not the reason I'm going out of order is that let's not blame parents here. Because unfortunately, the situation parents are confronted with is lack of consistency with the things we are doing. Why do we lower the age? If we say the children are brighter, why don't we say the 12-year-olds must vote, for example? If they are brighter, then we are saying they must vote when they are 18 because we are old, we don't understand. So if the youngsters, as you are saying, they are brothers and parents, so let's allow them to vote at 12 and drive cars and hand guns and so on. Why do we always make it easy to corrupt them on issues of morality? See, this is the problem our old people cannot understand. I understand what you are saying, that parents must take responsibility, and but they feel disempowered. The environment we created in a democracy, they feel disempowered. So I would urge that if we argue that the young people now are brighter, let us be consistent then. So there's no consistency in terms of principles here. It's only these things which are, eradicating morality all the time. So I would advise that these things are going to come back and bite us. I can guarantee you about that. And I agree with you, we need to do education. We cannot take the responsibility to educate, our children, to involve communities and so on and so on. But legally, I think we are shooting ourselves into the foot.
In my position, I am here to be persuaded by all of you. I come to my own decision and conclusion. Let's listen to one lady, she's sitting at the back, who said that we must diversify or differentiate when we deal with this matter. So that if you say you can allow a child of 16 to drink whiskey, you are not necessarily there saying that a child of 18 who can marry should not drink whiskey. So that kind of a differentiation. So the example that you're giving suggests that we should have one size fit all. But I'm saying there's another view. So for me, it's to listen to all the views, and this process is still continuing. At the end of the process, I have a very powerful team of members of parliament that they will put things right. If I'm out of order, they will also put me in order, I guess. And I'm excited about this because we have all this insight. Honorable Swart, and Honorable Bonga is here. He was not here when I was saying that he never suggested that people must relinquish their religion when they come to Parliament. I understood him to mean that we must look at the situation what is happening. If I misinterpreted it, he will raise his hands, but I think shaking his head in a but it's not anti-religion. A great supporter of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Honorable
Chair, I think we need to be careful of engaging one-on-one because we're running out of time. But I do, the issue whilst the court dealt with decriminalisation and did not deal with the aid of consent, it's an interesting discussion. You've touched it and we discussed it under the T issue, the different ages. Our law does recognise different ages for different issues. The custody sentencing is different ages. The courts treat children differently. Now, we also refer to our traditional practices, Chair. You refer to the issues of certain taboos in traditional practices. Why is it then that we have the age of circumcision, 16, not below 16? You may not consent to circumcision below 16 unless both parents are involved. Why virginity testing, for its pros and cons, virginity testing, Chair. 16, no child below the age of 16 can consent to virginity testing. Now we know there's abuse that takes place, but why do we say for those traditional practices, but we allow abortion for a child the age of 10? So you understand the inconsistency with the ages, and that is the point I want to make. I would love to hear from traditional authorities and for them to comment on these issues which were a means to protect children and were abused. Sure, we know virginity testing can also be abused, but I think, Chair, this highlights the way we're wrestling with these issues, that no one age fits all. And I think this is, as we go forward, we will further engage in this, Chair. Thank you.
The Jewish community's circumcised children below 16 at birth. You see the inconsistencies that are embedded in some of these cultures. Honorable Mr. Higgins.
Honorable Chairperson, I just felt that the Honorable MP, in addition to the comment about leaving Christianity at the gate, also made a comment about fatherhood. And he wasn't here when he responded to that. He was absent. Maybe he would like to elaborate on that. I just, for clarification's sake, want to repeat that. No, it's fine. For clarification's sake, just repeat that. I was referring to fatherhood in a broader, in a broader spectrum than subjectively my own personal home. Yeah.
Thanks, Chair. Sorry for leaving. I had to attend to other issues, but I think the summary of what we are saying is that we are Parliament, and now we are a committee of Parliament. We are receiving a lot of presentations. But the interesting point which I raised earlier was that we met a number of faith-based organizations. Some are saying, let's support. Some are saying, we are not supporting. So from where we're sitting in Parliament, we have to be in a serious predicament, because it's like in dealing with this matter, we're not using an objective tool, an objective test. When you are presenting an honorable member, because I'm a Christian, I was heavily touched by what you said, John, and I could feel that generally my conviction goes along with what you're saying. But at the same time, when another group comes, which is not generally Christian, Rastafarian and so on and so forth,
from where I'm sitting, I might be able to move from being Christian myself, not to believe in Christianity, because it's embedded in me. I move to a point where I must be objective. He says that I must also accommodate the views of the Rastafarian and accommodate the views of the one from the Catholic, yesterday it was Catholic bishops. So I must move from that point and be in the middle ground so that I get to be objective. So if we look at these things from the fact that from our own families, for instance, for example, just mentioning that this is how we grew up in your own family, or saying this is how we grew up in our own church. These churches are so many. And we've got to take a neutral route, we've got to attend to all these things. On the other side, there is a constitutional democracy that we're in. The constitution has to be respected to the last. We're compelled by that, but we need all the participation. In this context, we're not generally in line with you personally, as you said. I was just making an example of how we must get out from our own personal, our own religion, to accommodate all other sectors. Because Parliament is expected to represent all sectors of the community, faith base, traditional leaders, traditional healers, communists, because we also have capitalists, and everyone must be represented by us. So that is why we must get a common, always agree with Honorable Swartz. We need a common ground. So if we're in that ground, this ground, let's go to a common ground where we'll be able to strike a balance. The issue about the age, in legal terms, the menstrual always say it's a message. They will tell that a child between this one and this one cannot be criminally liable from this age, and that we don't always differentiate that. But if the problem is about the age, let's attack that message. Let us not use it as a motivation towards stopping a particular legislation or amendment to legislation. If we need to synchronize the issues of age or we see it different, let's make submissions. But no, let's look at the issue of the age. That is the problem. Let's do 1, 2, 3, 4. Because we're expected to build a society and a caring society for that matter. Thank you.
You were just stating a matter of a principle approach, and that's how we should work. So, Mr. Wickers, I hope you are happy now.
No, not at all, sir. Not at all, because fatherhood is not restricted to any particular faith. Fatherhood is a natural responsibility of every man that has been part of a child being born. And all this debate goes around children between the ages of 12 to 16. I assume they've all been fathered in some way or other, or lack parental fathering responsibility. And so my comment is based upon the issue of fatherhood, and the comments was made earlier, did not adequately respect that. And I think that to me is an indictment if we think of responsibility of children. So the rest of the explanation isn't really what I was after. I'm on the point of fatherhood. And that's why I said I'm not sure if the Honourable MP is a personally a father or not, because I said, until you become a parent, you don't understand and fully appreciate the responsibility of parenthood, and more so fatherhood, as head of home usually. Sorry? I will.
No, Honourable Member, I get your point, and I just want to make one sentence that I'm wondering whether these amendments, which are around morality, are serving our communities. You can go to all the communities in South Africa. Forget about people who have made representations. Just go to communities. No community will support a situation where, as government, we are saying, from 12 to 16 years, you must have, sex. Because there will not be consequences. That's why if you check between all societies, you will find that at least from 2018, 2021, and so on and so on. So what I'm trying to say is that let us not serve interests of small groups who have put their own agendas here. This is the point I'm making. Because most of the time, we always favor these people. If you check from 1996 to date, We always favor that. We ignore what the vast majority of our people believe in on issues of values. Take genocide, religion and so on. If you check our communities, we have common ground when it comes to values. That's why I'm saying, let us balance values and rights. Let's not lift rights beyond values. So let's find a perfect balance in that. I'm saying it's not the responsibility of one religious group. It's our responsibility. Let's really look into this matter. Otherwise, our society is suffering out there.
I don't think anyone in this committee says that we must allow children between 12 and 16 to have sex. We are not giving anybody any license. We are saying in front of the parents, grandparents, brothers and sisters, this is happening. And the solution we had was that we will charge and prosecute these children. And we are saying the consequences of that kind of legal profession is actually creating more problems to society and to the children themselves. Now, we want to do something that will be in the best interest of the children. And that's why we have invited you. And that's why next week we are continuing to have public hearings. We want your wisdom to say, how do we get out of that situation? So we have not yet come to the end. If you wish, you can come back again next week and make further contributions. So we are not imposing anything. Actually, if we had solutions, we would not have invited you to come. We invite you because we want to hear from you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I just want to ask the Honourable MP and myself if you could advise, what is the format that you'd like the faith-based organization to voice a disagreement? I'm asking this question because the comment that's come through is that there's always different views from the different faith-based organizations. Now, in the context of Alaska, I know there's a Council of Churches, which is more the organized body of what government usually consults on matters for faith-based organizations, but it doesn't necessarily represent all the FBOs. Now, my question is, how best would you then, as Parliament, want faith-based organizations to make input or represent their vehement opposition to this? How would you want it? What force? I'm saying this because it's one thing to make submissions. Let's say you receive 400 submissions to Parliament, perhaps those churches, perhaps those organizations, some were individuals, maybe there were 1,000 members of one church, whatever. There's different anecdotal evidence that you look at. But how is the best way to say, listen, of the 52 million in this country, 50 million are saying, look, what signatures, what is it that must be given to Parliament to say, we do not agree with this thing? What is it that must be submitted so that you see that actually, yes, there are some pockets of society that do agree, but the majority don't. What evidence must be given to you to prove this? I'm interested to know what kind of format would be submitted that's acceptable.
We respect the autonomy of all organizations in the country. We also respect the right of all organizations to associate with other organizations sharing the same objectives. All we are saying is that there are many things that as a faith-based organization, things that you can agree on outside there without coming to us, that it would actually assist if there is also dialogue amongst yourselves. So that when you come to appear before us, you have minimized the differences between or amongst yourselves. But we can't compel you to do so. And this also does not only apply to yourselves. We have the lawyers' organizations. You see, we have the Women's Center. We have the Legal Resources Center. The same can be said about them, to say, why don't you go and discuss this? But we have to respect their autonomy, because it doesn't mean that if they are all lawyers, they will always agree. Similarly, if you are religious bodies, you will not always agree. So we must give you space, and it's not a favor that we do to you, but we are saying that we need dialogue between
society, and we would encourage that without prescribing to you and denying you space, we can do that. This is where Parliament elected us to come here to serve you, not to serve ourselves. So don't worry. We are not saying next time if you have spoken to other organizations, don't come here. We are almost welcome, and we are also welcome to have your own opinion that does not agree with any other opinion. So this is our hope. So don't stress.
I was wondering, Chair, because personally I know the predicament Parliament is facing. Don't think that we don't understand. Once the Court has made a ruling, you are bound by that ruling. Now, and personally, I think probably we need to go deeper in terms of checking why these cases are always coming from the Constitutional Court. Because if you check most of the time, they were never initiated by our people, they were never initiated by Parliament. They come through legal processes, people are financed by somebody. But the question I'm asking, if under these circumstances we find ourselves in, to appear to be saying to our society and young children, now, once you are 12 years, you are free to practice, sex, whether you like it or not, honorable chair, that is the message our people are feeling on this matter. You can't change that. Because in the first place, you can check all over the world. There were laws which were preventing this to happen. Because society and nations knew the consequences. Now, this government, influenced by particular people, are changing the course. So this is what you must know. So I was wondering, is it possible then to look for an alternative legal way to empower microwaves, to empower society and structures which may be relevant to deal with this matter on a voluntary basis, if you like, but they are legally empowered to deal with issues, maybe outside criminality as the court is said to be considering that. I don't know whether you have considered that to protect, ourselves and take the views of the majority in that case. I'm just putting that for consideration.
He says, no, thanks. I really sympathize with this argument, but we'll have to take it further. We're not at a position where we're saying we have already taken decisions and so on and so forth, but that is why we're consulting. This is an ongoing consultative process. I think it reminds me, Chair, of the when we're dealing with the case of S versus Makwanya, where the issue about the death penalty itself, you see. We discuss it at length and so on and so forth. But let's discuss, but as we discuss, my appeal is that everyone must get out from their own views, original views that they hear, so that we want the common ground and want proposals and want solutions. Not only statements that seek to make us feel guilt about the processes, but what are the tangible solutions that we want to do about the issue of age. And we want assistance from everyone, agreeing or not agreeing, but to say the matter is what we're not saying, and that must be clear. We're not saying from 12 years they must tell our head, they must now go and do that activity. We're not saying so. This thing seeks to just decriminalize. And we're putting it into perspective, don't confuse our people. We don't confuse society with what we're saying from 12, now they can do what they want to do. But that thing, that thing is still not acceptable, but if it has happened, it's no longer a crime as it used to be before. So what interventions do religious leaders want to give to us? Let's get into those, fill in those gaps. I think we can take the discussion forward. We really sympathize with the whole argument, but let's do things the way they are. Thank you, Chair.
I will request the Media Department of Parliament to organize interviews for different members of Parliament so that these issues can be taken to a debate with European communities. And more importantly, that we should, as parliamentarians, explain, because failure to do so, somebody can go and say, Parliament says, allow children of certain age to have sex, Parliament is giving a license, and we are not giving a license to anybody to do this. We are saying there is a situation that must be addressed, and that situation is that we are making children criminals where they should not be criminals, and that has harsher consequences to our children than otherwise. But otherwise, this debate remains open. We will be here next week, and thank you very much for watching.
We, Joshua Generation Church, we on 4:41. Can I give? What? Oh. I've been here since early this morning. Can I finish? I'll try it quick. Thank you, Ken. Thank you. As I said, I'm here on behalf of Joshua Generation Church. A church in Western Cape having an attendance figure of approximately 2,400 people and 15 congregations. The submission was submitted by Andrew Shirley on behalf of the church. He also is the senior leader of 412 Global, which oversees 200 churches in South Africa and around the world. Firstly, I just want to make clear that we understand that the Constitutional Court has made a judgment on the issue and that this amendment is a fait accompli. We commend Parliament for implementing that which the Constitutional Court has already decided on. We understand the reasoning behind the amendment, and we agree that criminal prosecution of children under the age of 16 is not the answer to the problem of children engaging in consensual sexual activity under the age of 16. However, we submit that in the best interest of the children in South Africa, there should be an answer to that problem, and the amendment unfortunately does not, in its current form, make way for an answer to that problem. And so we submit that while the amendment is worded correctly for the implementation of the Constitutional Court judgment, it does not go far enough in the protection or interests of children of South Africa, and we submit it should not be left as is, but should be added to. With the age of consent essentially moving to the age of 12, South Africa is now going to have one of the lowest ages of consent in the world, and is joining a very small handful of countries that have an age of consent that is so low. With this in mind, I submit that Parliament has the responsibility to go the extra mile in protecting the children of South Africa against all the potential negative outcomes that can go hand in hand with a country having an age of consent that is so low. We are aware that there are positive outcomes to the amendments. The positive outcomes are outlined in the Constitutional Court judgment. However, we submit there are also negative outcomes, and Parliament should not ignore these. Referring to paragraph 81, it's important for Parliament to note that the Constitutional Court accepted that the purpose of discouraging adolescents from prematurely engaging in consensual sexual conduct is a legitimate and important purpose for Parliament to take into account. So the Court accepted that it's legitimate and important, and specifically that the discouragement is important. The Court further acknowledges at paragraph 97 that consensual sexual acts can carry the risk of psychological harm, pregnancy, and the contraction of STDs. So whilst they declared the criminality to be unconstitutional, which we are in agreement with, in paragraph 95, they give Parliament margin of appreciation and said that less restrictive means are available to achieve a purpose which they have said is legitimate and important. So they are wanting Parliament to implement less restrictive means. In paragraph 98, the Constitutional Court specifically says that there are various methods that Parliament can use in order to achieve this important and legitimate purpose, being the discouragement of adolescents to engage in sexual conduct. As such, we have to submit that due to the fact that South Africa is now joining a small handful of countries with age of consent is so low, and secondly, that the Constitutional Court has stated that the discouragement of adolescents is a legitimate and important purpose, and thirdly, that the Constitutional Court has said that the state can and should employ less restrictive means to achieve that purpose, we'd like to implore Parliament to recognise that as a legitimate purpose
and to apply such less restrictive means, whatever they may be. To put such big decision in the hands of children as young as 12 without ensuring that there are the proper mechanisms in place to inform them of the consequences of their decisions would not be responsible and would definitely not be in the best interest of the children of South Africa. We'd like to further add that there are potential scenarios that the amendment does not take into account. The first example would be the scenario where an adult encourages two children between the ages of 12 and 15 inclusive to engage in sexual activity in front of said adult or in front of somebody else. In terms of this amendment, such an act would not be illegal as the adult can now raise the defense of consent of the children. This would be a loophole in the legislation following this amendment and would submit that it is too important a loophole to ignore. In the best interest of the children of Africa, it's admitted that we need a clause dealing with this potential eventuality. Germany is one of the countries that has recognized this as a risk and has employed a clause similar to this example. Whoever abets the commission of sexual acts of a person under the age of 16 in front of him or herself in front of another person by acting as an intermediary or by encouraging to commit the sexual act or by furnishing or creating an opportunity shall be punished with imprisonment. Submitted that such a clause be added to the amendment in order to close this loophole for paedophiles and other sexual predators who would encourage children to engage in sexual activity in front of them or in front of somebody else. We do not want sexual predators to view South Africa as a soft target because of the low age of consent and loopholes in the current law. Germany has also added a very general clause stating that it's illegal to take advantage of an exploitative situation. This is a good clause because it allows the court to exercise the discretion when an act committed was clearly exploitative of the child, even if such act was done with the child's consent. An example was raised earlier by Honourable Member Swart with regard to gangs requiring an initiation for girls to join the gangs to engage in sexual activity. And even if the girl consents, a clause saying it's illegal to take advantage of an exploitative situation would allow the court to discretion to implicate people in that matter. As such, we admit that a similar clause is considered for South Africa. Furthermore, we'd like to ask the Parliament to consider that many countries of the higher age of consent, if the older person is in a position of authority over the younger person, such as a teacher, manager, coach, pastor, parent, or step-parent. This is the so-called position of trust rule, and it's applied in Sweden and Canada to name just two countries to deal with the issues of whether the person is under the perpetrator's care or under the authority of the perpetrator. We rather this be considered by Parliament. I think the legitimate problem we're facing is that nobody here and nobody in the Constitutional Court, and hopefully not many people in South Africa, believe that 12-year-olds should be engaging in sex. So although this law is correct in that it's closing a gap with regard to criminal prosecution, it does run the risk of becoming an anomaly. As such, we need to recognize the Parliament has a responsibility to fill that gap with other amendments. I'd just like to raise the potential red flags, which may not be relevant now, but could become relevant in future. If a portion of this responsibility is going to fall on faith-based organizations, which we have said it takes a village to raise a child and faith-based organizations should be involved, it is very important that a parliamentary policy be in place that faith-based organizations be allowed to teach in accordance with their beliefs and in accordance with the scripture. This is a freedom of religion, a freedom of conscience issue, but it is submitted that it becomes significant if faith-based organizations are going to be leaned upon and they should be leaned upon. The second issue is the issue of parental authority. And I agree with what my brother here said regarding consistency and congruency in the law. We can't on the one hand say that parental authority, the parents are responsible for the discipline of the children, and on the other hand discuss whether reasonable spanking should be allowed. There needs to be a holistic, when we look at the law, we've got to look at it in a holistic way, otherwise we end up with incongruencies. The third issue is that the constitutional judgment is based upon dignity and privacy of children, and it is a concern that this could be a slippery slope, the issue of dignity and privacy for children. Step one is already happening, sex is being decriminalized. Step two could potentially be take away the parents' right to interfere in the name of privacy and dignity. This right has already been taken away from parents with regard to abortion, and it's not a far stretch to imagine it could happen here. Step three, take away the church, mosque, shul right to preach abstinence until marriage. So the slippery slope issue is something that I would like Parliament to red flag for future. So As such, to sum up, the amendment does cover the requirements of the Constitutional Court with regard to the lifting of the criminal sanctions. It does not, however, provide for any less restrictive means to discourage adolescents from engaging in sexual conduct to the detriment, which the Constitutional Court has said is important and legitimate. And thirdly, neither does it cover for certain potential loopholes, which I have raised. As such, we request the Parliament go back to the drawing board with a view to considering all the potential negative outcomes of the amendment and attempt to close the loopholes that could exist to the detriment of the children of South Africa, as well as adding in measures that must be taken by the state to educate adolescents on all the risks involved with the very risky decision that is now going to be placed in very young hands. It is submitted there is a responsibility on Parliament to consider the fact that the removal of the criminal aspect leaves a void that must be filled by legislation if our children are going to be adequately protected. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for standing up for your rights. Now, I think that we will leave this message quite clear, and together with other messages to turn to us.
We need that written submission, and if the submitters have got any suggested wording changes, we would also appreciate that change, and not the text itself in accordance with what they have suggested.
Honourable Swart is saying something that all of us, all of us have to agree. So it's an opening decision to all of you. If you want to reformulate something in the sense that you have to, if you want to amplify the submission, the principles. Thank you very much. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.